Marcy? Okay. Good morning, everyone. Calling to order the board meeting of October 18th. Would you do the roll call, Marcy?
On the roll for the Board of Directors meeting of October 18th, 2017, Director Abe Koga, Director Barrett,
here.
Director Canepa,
here.
Director Chavez,
here.
Director Cutter, here. Director Joya, Director Groom,
present.
Director Haggerty, Director Kaplan,
here.
Director Kim, Director Miley, Director Mitchell, Director Ju, Director Ronan, Director Ross,
here.
Director Sanchez, Director Sheehy,
here.
Director Sinks,
here.
Director Sparing, Director Wagon Connect, Director Zane, Secretary Rice, Vice Chair Hudson,
here.
Chair Niss,
here.
We have a quorum.
Good. Thanks so much. Thank you all for being here. And I've asked Dave if he would leave us in the Pledge of Allegiance.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you, Dave. It's been kind of a sober past week. We're going to spend a lot of time today discussing what has happened, who the heroes have been in all this, and also what a leading role the Air Board has taken during the fires, not only to the north, but now also for us in the peninsula, also heading over toward the beach area. So with that, I'm looking at the consent calendar, and do you have any, did I hear you wanted to pull one, or someone wants to speak to one?
That's correct, item 6.
Okay, they don't want to pull it, they just want to speak to it, correct?
Okay.
In the meantime, if there is no other comment, could I...
Yeah, I'll move items 2 through 5 and number 7 on the consent calendar.
She didn't pull it, she just wants to comment.
That's okay.
You can move the whole thing.
No, she will do it because it has to be unanimous. And
okay, well, we have just a little parliamentary procedure here.
We got a motion and a second.
Yeah, but with the...
Okay, no, I'll do the consent calendar.
All right, we'll vote on that. Now. Wait, you just heard what the motion was. We're going to vote on it. And then
I'm sorry, I was talking to Dave. I did not hear it.
Do you want to repeat it, Dave?
I had it 2 through 5 and number 7 on the consent calendar. I was the motion. I think Rebecca was the second.
Yes. Everything but the one that was...
Yeah, and we'll clear those. And
I see. Okay.
So would you vote, please? Any dissension on that? If not, would the person who wants to speak to number 6 come forward?
I actually have 4 cards.
Well, then would the persons who want to speak to number 6 come forward?
So I have Mark Brett, Bob Brown, Paul Adler, and Mark Ventura.
Hi, good morning, board members. My name is Mark Brett, and I'm an executive for Anvil Engineering, an industrial engineering services firm servicing the oil and gas industry. I wanted to make 3 short comments for you to consider before the final ruling 11-18.
Yeah.
Only 4% of acute toxicity weighted emissions in the Bay Area come from industrial and commercial equipment. The newly proposed 10 ppm TAC threshold limit is purposefully conservative to put this exposure risk into perspective as far as risk. An odds of an injury from mowing the lawn is 1 in 3,623. An odds of death from an airplane crash, higher, 1 in 9,821. And the odds of contracting cancer at today's threshold limits while standing outside a refinery 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, for 30 consecutive years is 1 in 10,000. So Rule 1118 should not be adopted because it's punitive, it's unscientific, and it's harmful to local businesses and consumers. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Next speaker.
Good morning, board directors. My name is Mark Ventura, and I work for Phillips 66. A couple of points. The I work for the refining industry, and we have a few other companies here represented. And I would like to say that, yes, I am proud to be part of a company that produces fuels that have been enabling fire trucks, helicopters, air tankers to control the fires that have been ravaging the Bay Area. So, you know, it's not all bad. Without those fuels, more lives probably would have been lost, more properties would have been damaged. The other point is, we often hear in this venue that refineries and industries generate terrible air conditions in the Bay Area. But again, in this past week, we've seen that one of the worst air conditions probably in the United States, and it's not due to the industry, it's not due to even the cars and the vehicles around the Bay. So the point I want to make here for this Rule 1118 is we really need to consider how much money we're going to be spending for what benefit we're going to get. And is this the best way to spend as a group, industry, residents, millions if not billions of dollars for what benefit? And maybe there's other programs that could be more effective in limiting a negative impact to the area. Thank you.
Thank you. Our next speaker.
Good morning, members. Bob Brown with the Western States Petroleum Association. First of all, to the board members impacted by the fires, and hats off to the Air District staff for around-the-clock work I'm sure they're doing to address the needs up in those communities. And so thank you very much. I want to talk about 1118 as well. Risk is a probability, so 10 in a million risk means there's 1/1,000th of 1% chance a maximum exposed person will contract cancer. More than 80% of risk is coming from diesel PM by the district's own analysis. And 1118, despite recent amendments, leaves very little room to incorporate a 25 in a million threshold, which is consistent with South Coast and San Joaquin. And we've enumerating these points in much more depth in a letter we submitted on Monday evening. There's no measurable difference in risk between 10 in a million and 25 in a million. However, the costs of complying with 10 in a million risk are substantially greater. It also treats facilities differently based on business type, not risk. For example, public agencies will get additional time to comply, acknowledging substantial cost and time frame challenges, which are the same challenges faced by the private sector. And further, in my communications with other impacted industries, like the funeral industry, the hospitals, it appears that there's very little knowledge going forth about the depth and the impact of this regulation. For that, we think this rule is certainly sweeping, expensive, and complex enough to warrant further deliberation as to its impact and further public engagement. More time is needed to implement the appropriate risk reduction plan to move from 100 to 25, and only then to assess next steps for any secondary threshold that the district subsequently determines is necessary. Realistic and actionable timeframes are critical to form this plan. We've only recently seen the staff report and socioeconomic report, leaving very little time to analyze. We've continued disappointment with the rulemaking process because the TBARC draft workbook guidance document should include input from the affected facilities, and that collaboration with CARB's TBARC clearinghouse should also be included. These should be consistent control measures. We'd like to see a technical assessment of the 25 in a million included so that the board can compare this with the 10 in a million proposal for a fact-based risk analysis. And we'd hope to see a dispute resolution process and a clear definition of TBART. We advocate establishing a technical review committee to help with a review of BART, which would be critical in assessing the facts. And I know that the district's advisory council is meeting on the 30th, and we hope to see this on the agenda. Thank you.
Thank you. One last speaker.
Good morning, Chairwoman Niss and fellow board members. My name is Paul Adler with Phillips 66, and just to reiterate some of the other comments, when you're looking at the adoption hearing, which is going to be on November 15th, I really think it would be important to get the opinion and the assessment from your advisory council regarding the threshold limit number. Right now, the proposed number by staff, and they have included it in, obviously, their staff report, is 10 parts per million. But being able just to be able to differentiate, okay, what's the difference if we have a 25 parts per million threshold versus the 10, and receiving input from your advisory council could give you some additional knowledge and background in your decision making. So again, as Mr. Brown had mentioned, potentially bringing this topic and this discussion point up to your advisory council and getting their interpretation is what I'm asking of the board today. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Any other comments on this one? In that case, then, we also need a motion to pass this.
Yeah, I'll move item six.
May I ask a question about that?
Of course.
Thank you. There were a couple of requests to have the advisory council have an opportunity to weigh in on 1118, and that just didn't seem like an inherently unreasonable question, so I wanted to just ask staff if that is something that is being done or could be done or...
Madam Chair, Director Kaplan, we don't agree with that. I think the Advisory Council's resources ought to be spent where there is, there needs to be some deliberation and a knowledge gap filled in, if you will, relative to the understanding of what the impacts are going to be in terms of toxic air contaminants on local communities by large stationary sources, which is what 1118 is all about. We don't think it makes sense to bring it back. We don't think that they can necessarily add value at this point. So that's been our answer back and continues to be.
And then the vote today is simply to set the hearing for November 15th.
That's correct.
Of any feedback people want to give regarding the content of the rule itself, that vote takes place, then people can come and share that or write ahead of that time if they want to give specific suggestions about the content or structure of the rule.
Right. This is a proposed rule that's been out on the street. There's a socioeconomic impact analysis, a CEQA document that's all connected in terms of its evaluation of the impacts. All that's out for public process, and we're just following our normal public process in terms of rulemaking. What we typically do the month before you're to hear a particular rule is we typically try to let the public know we're setting this hearing, and it's just another formal notification process. It's not required. We just do it because it's a matter of practice to let particularly the affected industry know that we are, as staff, anticipating bringing this rule to your for your consideration.
And then my last question is, are we separating out the users who are either the smaller ones or the ones where the only item was a diesel generator for their own process, or is that...
Right, that's not included in the proposal now. If you're a facility who's only in there because of the risk associated with a backup generator, we've elected to not have that included in this proposal.
Okay, thank you.
Jim Sparing.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Jack, how are you going to evaluate the cost? I mean, what process are you going to go through? I mean, I'm assuming you're going to give us a cost benefit. You're going to look at 10 and then 25 and give us a comparison of what the benefits you get by going to 10 from 25. But how do you actually evaluate the costs of what that is, the difference between the 10 and 25? And the other question is, are there going to be exceptions to the rule? I mean, is there going to be sectors that are not going to be subject to the rule at the same time frame?
So I'm going to ask Mr. Nudd to answer some questions, but Director Spearing, so as I indicated to Rebecca Kaplan, Director Kaplan, excuse me, so this is a proposed rule that we've actually been working on for some time. I just kind of want to remind the board that if you recall, this was actually a rulemaking that we had initially thought we'd bring it to you for your consideration as far back as June of this year. And so we've been working quite extensively with the affected facilities, getting also community input. And really the heart of a lot of this rulemaking has to do with what are the type of requirements we're anticipating sources to install to lower their risk. And really what the crux of this proposal, which you'll hear about in a month from now, is really requiring facilities to meet a 10 in a million risk standard. We're not proposing a 25 as an alternative. We're simply identifying what we believe is most cost-effective, most protective of public health, and establishing that standard and expecting facilities to be able to meet that standard over a fairly robust time frame. And there's a number of parts of the proposal that allow them additional time as well to be able to get down to that standard. So we think we've developed what we think is not only health protective, but also reasonable with regard to the sources coming into compliance with this standard. I don't know, Mr. Nutt, did you want to add to my remarks?
Just a couple of things, Director Sparing. In terms of how we evaluated the cost and benefits, the rule is designed to be very flexible. So we set the risk action level, and then the facility can decide how they get there. So it's not a typical rule where we're saying, okay, everybody's got to put on SCRs, we know how much these cost, and that's how it's going to work. So when we did the economic analysis and the CEQA analysis, we made some engineering assumptions, some calculations about what equipment would likely to be installed. We costed out that equipment, and we compared it with the revenue and the profits from the associated industries. So we used the same methodology that we typically use in our socioeconomic reports, but we had to make a few more assumptions because of the way this rule plays out and its kind of inherent flexibility.
It would be good if you can just give us some of the details as to how you figure those costs. You know, yes. I'd like to understand the methodology. The last question is, are there going to be exceptions?
I guess I'm not sure I understand the question.
So probably, Director Spang, let me answer that question. There's not an exception. Instead, what we decided to do is really decide who's part of this proposal. And we decided to not include, for example, gas station facilities, which can pose a considerable risk in neighborhoods, in part because the technology isn't there to get further reductions from gas stations. And so there's also some we need to work further with the state to do a better job of estimating what the leak is from some of their operations as well. And so we fully anticipate to bring gas stations back into this proposal, but just not at the present time. And similarly, if a facility's risk is primarily driven by their diesel backup generators, we elected not to include them at this time. So facilities like hospitals, facilities who are just, say, for a hotel that just has a backup generator, we need a little bit more time as to make available, frankly, how do you control those emissions and things like that. Yeah, so we kind of took a different approach rather than having exceptions and instead just refined down exactly who's inside this proposal. So our socioeconomic analysis is out on the street, as I indicated earlier, and I'm sure hear comments on that as a result inside the public hearing next month. I'll just also remind the board that this proposal from staff, we believe, is one of the most important, significant, and substantial regulatory proposals that this board can and should consider in terms of being able to take steps to protect communities in and around the Bay Area from stationary sources. This has been part of the conversation and dialogue around the refinery rules, and you've heard us as staff come back to you, indicate to you that, frankly, we think a more substantive step, frankly, is to require that all stationary sources come down to a 10 in a million risk, and that's what this is. That's what this proposal is all about. You'll hear about it on November 15th.
Did you have a further question? Okay, great. No. Thanks. Cindy.
Thank you. I just had a couple of requests, and one is a request for information, and that is when we normally do economic analysis, this has been something I've been curious about in general, do we ever go back and determine whether or not we were correct?
I can tell you over time, Director Chavez, that we are extremely conservative with regard to our cost estimates, and almost always we have found that we way overestimated what the costs are. And we do that purposely. Almost always, industry figures out how to sit there and come into compliance in a much more cost-effective way, reducing their emissions, meeting the standard, but almost always never observing or expecting the kind of cost we anticipated in the socioeconomic impact.
So analysis. Do we do a third-party external analysis?
And that's how it's done.
And has that ever been presented to the board? Because I don't think I've seen it since I've been here.
It's part of the rulemaking. So when we...
No, I meant post. So we go through the rulemaking process, we do the analysis, and then we go back a year or two later and say we were accurate or we weren't accurate. That's really what I was asking.
Mm. It's a good idea.
I think that'd be especially a good idea for this rule because of the inherent flexibility, we can report back regularly to the board on process and costs and benefits, kind of keep people
And
apprised.
I would actually recommend, we've some of the analysis we've done two of them that frankly, I think myself and Jim, maybe you requested this too, that we were really pressing ourselves to do a little more survey work on the front end. And in some of those, and I can go back and look through my notes, I'd love to recommend at least two of them for a third-party analysis. And there are organizations I know that do the economic analysis for us. It'd be interesting to get their counterparts to check their homework. So, okay, good. I'm glad I'll be looking forward to seeing that come back to us. And then my second question is, as it relates to this item, I may be conflating two different rules. So if I am, feel free to send me back to the correct rule. When we had a discussion here about making sure that the implementation and the analysis of the health benefits was done by an outside third party. Is that this rule that we did that with? I remember it was a board discussion, and I thought, oh, that's a really good point, that we wanted to make sure that the data collection was accurate.
What I think you're referring to was the health risk assessments that were associated with this regulation. Generally, in the past, for certain things, we've allowed facilities to hire a third party, but it was the board's wish on this occasion that that actually be overseen by the staff and not to have the facility enter into direct contract, and that's how this regulation has been set up.
So when it comes back to us, I wanted to do two things. One, I want to make sure that the contractual relationship is with the board, because I think the oversight, you know, having someone pay us to make sure that I think it's hard for someone to hire their own contractor and then to press on them to get the data that we're asking for. However, I also want to make sure that the communication between the institution that's being evaluated and the contractor is such that they get their work done in a fast, collaborative way. And so when the rule comes back to us, I just want to understand the implementation, because what I'd much rather have than us having to hire more staff, frankly, to do some additional analysis, I'd rather have the contracts be evaluated through us, the performance be evaluated through us, but the work being able to be streamlined between the organizations. And I have two reasons for being interested in that. One is that at least one, when we, at a city level, I remember when we did some developmental analysis, that we wanted especially CEQA, the contract to be with us, but the information sharing and the speed of that was actually enhanced by the two parties being able to work together. But the oversight was ours, and so the people knew who they were performing the work for. So that's the outcome I want without impeding ability. And then coupled with that, I was curious about when we do the analysis of what it costs to do the HRA, whether or not... If we're wrong about the cost, you know, because some of these facilities are huge, do we go back to the contract to the person who the institution that we're evaluating and ask them to put in more money to the contract, and or in advance do we ask for some money to be put in escrow, giving us the flexibility and frankly even the company the flexibility to do a more refined job, and especially given that this is something newer that we're doing, I want to make sure that flexibility is built in, frankly, for both parties, both for the institution we're evaluating and for us in terms of gathering our information. And if you could just make that an option for us, and if the board likes it, great, and if they feel uncomfortable with it, you know, I'll have that argument then. Is that okay?
I think so, and I think we're actually following the direction you're laying out already, if Director Chavez, because the board has talked about this when it was being potentially considered for your consideration back in the spring of this year. And the comment that was made several times back to us was, don't let the fox guard the hen house kind of thing. So we understood that to mean that we are going to go ahead and be in charge of working through the emissions inventory estimates with the facilities themselves, making sure there's complete agreement there. We conduct the HRA. We conduct the HRA, which is a different model, health risk assessment, excuse me. And then, indeed, we then start to make sure that there's it's more of our saying, yes, this is the risk that you pose in the community, not you saying that you think you pose this risk in the community. Because I think the community is going to be better served with having the district play that role.
And us, we're playing that role through the contract.
Correct.
Got it.
But we are, I apologize, excuse me, please. But we are having to augment the staff on this proposal. And we think that's a good thing.
And is that for contract oversight?
It's a little bit both. We're going to be hiring permanent staff, plus we're also going to be contracting some of it as well. So it's a little bit of a
combination. Yeah, and I would really like to see the staff with roles and responsibilities defined, because I'd want to make sure that long term that's the wisest investment, because I do think we want expertise in house. I think that's righteous around the HRAs, but I also want to make sure that we're not creating an undue burden if we're really trying to push the envelope, and that's the balance I think we're trying to have. Okay.
So all you'll see a lot of that balance on the 15th.
We have two more of us to speak and one person in the audience who's asked to contribute as well. So Karen and then Dave and anybody else that I've missed here, so would you just wave at me? Okay, got everyone?
Thank you, Madam Karen. Chair. Two questions, Jack. I recall asking way back when 1118 was first proposed, or we've had updates. As a non-scientist, obviously 10 parts per million makes sense as a better health goal than 25. But I've always wanted to know why staff is recommending going from 25 to 10. And I'm hoping that will be in the staff report that we get, because I still don't have a clear understanding, especially when other like air districts are at 25. So I'm seeing nodding heads, so there will be a very clear explanation. Okay. The second question I have, you stated that the advisory committee, you didn't feel it was a good use of resources. Who makes the decision about what the health our advisory committee takes up? Do they only get to take up things that staff recommends, or can they say to you, we want to take this issue up and we want issues? Because we had them weigh in on 1216, and I'm not sure I understand your comment that it isn't worthy to have them weigh in on 1118, especially on this 25 versus 10 parts per million.
Largely because I think what we're talking about is establishing a risk management threshold. Yes. That's a decision that the board needs to be able to make. And could there be some further evaluation of some of the uncertainties associated, for example, of undifferentiated PM? And what I'm talking about there is there's some sources out there like refineries that emit PM that aren't necessarily a diesel PM. That's the kind of scientific assessment that I need the advisory council to focus on. And that's what, in fact, we are kicking that over to the advisory council to do an evaluation, come back, we think, in about a year, I believe. It'll take us a while to do that analysis. That's the type of scientific assessment that I think is really where the scientists on our advisory council should spend their time. Director Mitchoff, if that makes sense.
Well, it does, but I'll respectfully disagree, because the concept of 25 parts per million versus 10 parts per million, to me, as a layperson, is a scientific issue I would have liked them to have weighed in on. But the second part of that question was, who decides what they get to work on? Can they come to you and say, we want, whatever it is, we want to look at this, or do they only get to take up issues that staff sends to them?
Well, so this version of the advisory council is actually only about less than 2 years old. There used to be a broader, bigger group that, frankly, we felt it needed to be recast, if you will. So this group, the staff has, the staff so far has been saying these are some of the issues we need to have the advisory council evaluate and look at. And as part of the retreat, I sought to be able to let you all know that that's what I think the advisory council ought to focus on. Because I believe it should be an iterative process. I believe it shouldn't be staff. It should be also the board letting you all decide as to what issues you think ought to be coming to them. And so I was planning to bring this issue and this kind of discussion as part of the retreat in January to let you know we think the advisory council ought to be evaluating the following kind of topics.
And I appreciate that, but I think we do need to have that conversation. I appreciate that the board could provide requests, but I think there needs to be the flexibility. That's why we have this group, and so we'll talk about it at our retreat. So I'd ask my colleagues to think about that, that they have more expertise, I'll just say, than myself. You may all have more expertise. But I would want them to come to us and say, hey, we want to look at this or that, maybe having to get authority then from the board. But I don't like the idea that it's just a one-way street about what they take up. So let's talk about that at the retreat. Thank you.
I'm up. I had 2 points that got lost in this. We're talking about economics and how everything seems to flow. The idea of a report card came up from Mike Miller, Phillips 66, back in May when we were having meetings, and we all agreed it was a pretty good idea. Now, I don't think 6 months after we adopt a rule is enough time to see what value there is in what we did. But after a year and every 6 months, there's nothing wrong with that. I'm just not sure which committee it would go to. The second point was brought up by our own executive officer, Jack Broadbent, in that we were trying with the cap to keep more of the money, like in cap and trade, in our area, because there's no guarantees that that money stays in this area. It's back to the same idea. Are we getting value for the regulations, the rules that we're presenting? So if we can keep that in mind, when November 15th comes around and we start the process of the discussion for 1118, which hopefully does not go into 2018, it would be much appreciated, and I'll wait to hear from our one person in the public.
Okay, no other board members want to comment, so we have one last person from the public. Welcome.
Right there. Good morning. My name is Don Stock. I'm a resident of Benicia. I've lived there for 30 years with my kids and my grandkids, and I work in Richmond for a construction company. We have about 500 employees. The two things I'm hoping that this report in November will address: one, the difference in the cost-benefit ratio between the 10 parts per million and the 25. I'm like you, I try to say, is does that mean one person out of every million is going to potentially get cancer? Just the exact wording on it. The other thing is, I know you're looking at the expense to industry, but have you transferred that down to the expense to the consumers, us individuals? Because we all know, the refineries, if they're the ones that are going to be burdened with this, are just going to pass it on with higher tax or gasoline costs. I was in Florida this summer. Gas was 80 cents a gallon cheaper. I was just bewildered by that. So anyway, if you could address those, I'd appreciate that. Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate all of the comments, and I know this will be probably an extended and lively discussion when we actually get to it. So with that, a motion.
I'll move. Item 6.
Well, we did, I think. Didn't we?
Did what?
I moved 6, and I thought Carol seconded
it. Carol seconded it?
Yes.
Okay. In that case, if there's no dissension, then we will go on with the rest of our meeting, which takes us to committee reports. And thanks to Dave Hudson, because I cannot be here on Mondays, he ran the executive committee meeting.
Yes, he did. The committee met on Monday, October 16th, and approved the minutes of July 31st, 2017. The committee then reviewed and discussed the presentation update on wildfires. The committee then received Hearing Board quarterly report captioning July to September of 2017. The committee then reviewed and discussed the presentation Bay Area Regional Collaborative update. Finally, the committee reviewed and discussed the staff presentation contract award for records management system procurement and implementation. The committee recommends that the board authorize the executive officer, air pollution control officer, to execute a contract with Xerox in an amount not to exceed $650,000 for records management system. The next meeting of the executive committee will be held on Monday, November 20th. Bay Area Air Quality Management District office at 375 Beale, that's here, at 9:30. I move that the board approve the executive committee's recommendation. This concludes the chair's report. Do I have a second?
Good. Okay, in that case, are there any comments on this before we vote on it? Okay, if there's no dissension, we will move forward.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Over here.
Who is...
Kaplan, I just wanted to request, as we're talking about the records management system, that, you know, there have been a variety of questions raised about which, you know, we've gotten some press inquiries and such about the records management dispute, which took place previously. And so I'd like to request that at a future item, as we're acquiring a new records management system, that at some point, if we could get an update to help clarify our records retention policy, that there's been some question about what it is or what it's supposed to be. And so if at some point we could have a hear back on, as we're implementing a new system, could we have clarity about what is our policy about records retention? Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Rebecca. And seeing no other committee reports, we're going to go on to number 9. Which is going to be an update on the wildfires. And let me just take prerogative as the chair for a few minutes. I don't think I have ever been more pleased and proud to be part of this particular board of directors since Sunday last week. This group absolutely not only sprang into action, but provided the mask. You all have a mask here at your place. But also kept the public incredibly informed. I know people were working around the clock, absolutely. And I know Lisa in particular was on this all the time. So if there was ever a chance for us to really do our part for public health, I think it's been over the past week. This has been an incredible time. Teresa and I talked earlier because she said Petaluma has been spared, but they are part of the emergency response. Shirley Zane cannot be here this morning, and I hope when we get to that point where we're doing some updates, you'll allow me to plug her in for a few minutes so she can fill you in on Sonoma. But this has been unprecedented, but if there's ever anything that I think speaks to what we do as a board of directors, this past week has been a clarion cry. So I'm so proud of all of you and delighted to be serving, and I know all of you are as well. So Jack, this is your opportunity to be the star of the show.
Oh, I would say that those are the firefighters and all the first responders. But thank you, Madam Chair and members of the board. This item here is an update on really the staff's efforts to help respond and address the impacts of the wildfire, essentially the largest urban wildland fire, I believe it's being characterized. This fire, as you all should understand, and I'm sure you do, has resulted in the highest PM concentrations we've ever experienced here in the Bay Area.
Don't forget the comparison to Beijing.
Right. And that is actually Ms. Fasano, which, by the way, I think really works because I've heard that now repeated by many, many folks, and it really does give a good visual.
Over and over.
Just at the outset, I want to let you all know this has been a team effort. There's been multiple teams involved to help respond and really assist. It has included our meteorologists, our people who've done all the forecasting, all of our communications staff that's headed up by Lisa Fasano. our permitting staff has actually helped in terms of just expediting the need to get in, or really expediting the processes to get in portable equipment and generators and that kind of thing. That's all there to help fight the fire. And then also, as you indicated, Madam Chair, there's been my enforcement staff has really stepped up to be able to secure and distribute masks, which is an unusual step, but we felt it was necessary in this really unprecedented situation. Mr. Keno is going to give you a talk, and I think it's multifaceted because it's multi folks who are going to be part of this presentation. And for those of you that were on the executive committee, this is a little bit of a repeat, but also an update based on the input we received by the executive committee. So let me hand it over to Mr. Keno. And Madam Chair, I'll let you decide as to when you want to pull in Director Zane. I know she has expressed an interest, could not be here today, because of all the need for her to be involved in a number of meetings locally, but wanted the opportunity to patch in by phone. And so we're prepared to do that for you.
Whenever okay. You'd like. I would think in 10 or 15 minutes okay. After we get through a variety of things, including the fact that I, as I said, I hope you'll share the website. I'm sure everyone has been to the website. I think it's particularly good. And I know people have been using it extensively.
It, so many people we had it started to glitch a little bit over the weekend, but we fixed it quickly. So let me hand it over to Mr. Keno.
Good morning, Chair Niz, members of the board. Good morning. As Jack said, and as you have said, this is an unprecedented event that we had here in the Bay Area, and we've been responding the best we can. We have so much help in this district, from all the staff to you guys on the board. Everyone's been pitching in, doing their part the best we can. We've been brainstorming, coming up with ideas, and just reacting the best we can. And I'm here to present some of that information to you along with some other people.
Madam Chair,
sure.
If I can make a suggestion, we're being told that Director Zane needs to be able to, if she could, patch in now. Okay.
So I think that's fine. I don't think the time is critical.
Right.
I want to hear from you, Wayne, but I think if we could have Shirley just fill us in now, that would be good. How would you like to do this?
Great. She's
okay.
Actually in her offices, so where we posted
great.
It.
Great. So staff is going to handle this. Thanks.
Right. I have Marcy hopefully going to dial her in. Right. Okay.
Shirley intended to be here, by the way, and said that, as you probably know, Santa Rosa took the brunt of this, and they are deep into the OES aspect of it as well.
Hello, this is Michelle.
Hi, Michelle.
Hello.
Michelle?
Yes.
Michelle, it's Liz Niss. Can you patch Shirley in, please?
I can. Hold on.
Good music.
Hi,
in Santa
this is
Rosa.
Director Zane.
Good morning, Director Zane.
Good morning.
You are front and center. We are featuring you this morning as the out-of-town voice.
Well, thank you. I think there's a lot to learn and a lot to discuss from this catastrophic disaster that has had such an impact on our mission statement up here in Santa Rosa.
The floor is yours, Shirley. You can.
Okay, the floor is mine. Okay, I thought you were going to ask me a question.
Nope.
Okay, I'm going to go ahead and just dive in then.
Dive in.
So you guys haven't done the PowerPoint yet, correct?
Not yet.
Okay, good. All right. I'm just going to talk about just a few things. Obviously, we've had this catastrophic disaster, and if you came up here and came to our fairgrounds or our emergency operations center, you would be absolutely shocked. We have about 10,000 people that have come in to help us with this disaster. It's been so horrific. I did a flyover with our sheriff and our congressman on Monday afternoon, and there were fires everywhere, and I can tell you three communities in Santa Rosa, one within my district, were just absolutely gone. The fires whipped in at 60 miles an hour. They went over the hills. They destroyed most of Mark West, Larkfield community, most of Fountain Grove, which I represent, two mobile home parks. We've had about 40 deaths to date. We still have another 60 missing persons that we're actively trying to find. And then Coffee Park, which a lot of you have seen on the news over and over again. So whether you were poor or middle class, working class, or whether you were wealthy, like the hospital CEOs, all three of them that lived up in Fountain Grove, that all three of them lost their houses. This fire did not discriminate. It is the great social equalizer when you look at fires and what they can do to a community. And on the positive side, it is a great unifier, and I couldn't be more proud of my community right now. And I couldn't be more grateful for resources from the Air District and our regional resources. I mean, probably every single one of you sitting there on the board has actually sent resources to us. Sorry, I'm getting emotional right now. But if you look on my Facebook, you'll see a list of emergency response teams from cities and county and state, national, even two countries, Australia and New Zealand, who have come in to fight these fires and to assist with our rescue missions. We are going to have a long road to rebuild. We are going to need the Air District in terms of helping us with the health impacts, because although the smoke is not as bad as it was last week, where you could barely go outside, and as Jack told me several times, it is the highest, the most unhealthy air they've ever measured. But we also are going to need more support as we begin in the next 3 months to go into the recovery stage, where we have to clean up massive amounts of debris. And the FEMA director, Brock Long, flew in yesterday with the EOS director, Garducci, and the CAL FIRE director. And it was great to have him here, the FEMA director, to see the devastation we've experienced. We're going to need all the support we can get. And I was looking at the PowerPoint, and it's really good. I will say that there's two things I would like from the Air District. One is that I would like to please keep sending those masks, because if people are going to need them. It's not like you need them for 1 week and then you don't need them anymore. The quality of the air here continues to be extremely unhealthy and puts a lot of seniors and children, especially with asthma and bronchial diseases, at risk. I talked to Jack this morning and the executive committee, and I asked that you please be in constant contact with our Dr. Karen Millman, our medical officer, and as well as Barbie Robinson, our director of health services, to collect data from our hospitals regarding the types of health care incidents that are happening when people show up in the ERs or the urgent care centers. We did have two out of our three large hospitals, Kaiser and Sutter, close for over a week. They had to evacuate people in the middle of the night when the fire swept through. It's amazing that they didn't burn down, quite frankly, because when we flew over, we saw fire everywhere around the hospitals, and they were able to save the hospitals. And so we've had a real difficulty providing all the care we need, but Memorial Hospital has done a good job, St. Joseph's. We also have the largest healthcare clinic was up on the hill in Fountain Grove. It's had severe damage. It meets the needs of 27,000 people in our community, largely Latino families and people on Medi-Cal in our partnership program. So the county lost a major health care deliverer. They will reopen, but not for another 9 months. So we're in need of some type of, you know, mobile clinics. Our evacuation sites, shelters are still open, still housing about 1,500 people. We have not allowed people to go back into the Fountain Grove area yet where I represent people because there's just too much dangerous situations there. They're still restoring utility lines, still getting trees out. This is going to be a very long process of recovery, but right now CAL FIRE is in the repopulation phase where we're putting people back, letting people go back. They have to go through an entry point and sign certain waivers. There's really an urgent need to get information out to the community, which we're working on. We'll have two town hall meetings on Thursday and Friday regarding sifting through things versus debris. And when you remove debris, that's when you start getting into all kinds of toxic and environmental issues that obviously affect people's health and the air. Sifting is different. It's just really sifting through just the ashes to see if you can find any valuables. I will tell you that these fires were so hot, they melted tires off of cars, and I saw in a memory care living apartments the other day, and the only thing standing, the metal was all twisted, was Mexican pottery. It turns out they make that with really high heat. And so the Mexican pots and the Mexican fountains are still standing, whether it be in the very wealthy homes or whether it be in the mobile home parks. That's the one thing you see. And that's about it, really, honestly, because it didn't just blow through, and it was 60-mile-an-hour wind. So I know the firefighters have all said, you know, there was nothing that was going to stop this. And sadly, it went right into these urban neighborhoods. But since then, we've brought in the cavalry, and like I said, we've got 10,000 people here. The National Guard, Scott Haggerty, if you're there, I know your family members have been in the military service. I can't say enough about the National Guard. They have protected our communities from looters, and we are really doing a pretty good job of keeping people out. We've arrested less than 20 people in terms of the sheriff and the city of Santa Rosa. And we've had curfews as well. So the curfews have lifted. We're repopulating. And now we have that long process of grief that we have to go through. And I think grief is just beginning to set in. And it's funny because I have not been emotional for the last 9 days because I have to be strong and the leader for this county. And now I'm talking to all of you, and I'm having a hard time getting through this. But I'm going to keep going, if you can excuse the tears. I would like to see, and I don't know, Jack, whether this has happened or Liz, but it seems to me to put an Air District employee in our Emergency Operations Center here would be a good thing. We have FEMA. We have lots of health. It is just absolutely amazing what they've done over there at the Emergency Operations Center. And it will be open for quite some time. So if there's any way that maybe we could get an employee up here, I think that would be a good thing. The person to talk to would be either Dr. Karen Millman or Barbie Robinson, our medical officers and directors of health that are over there staffing that Emergency Operations Center. The other thing is calling Cheryl Bratton, who's our emergency officer and our CAO. I guess the only other thing I wanted to say to you is that we are going to need some disaster relief. But again, on terms of the Air Board, being able to monitor and give timely reports on the air are really important. When I looked at the PowerPoint, I noticed that Santa Rosa wasn't in there, Jack, and I don't know whether there are monitors in Santa Rosa, but there should be because I went down the list and I saw all of these names in terms of the summary of daily average PM concentrations on slide 11. So maybe you could answer that. Is there more monitoring going on up here now that includes Santa Rosa?
Yes.
Yes, Director Zane, we do. We have now a monitor up. It's one of the EBAMs, actually, that are up in Santa Rosa. That chart there shows a white line across the Santa Rosa, unfortunately, and it's right in the middle of the chart. But it does actually. So.
Okay.
We do have the updated PowerPoint for the board.
Yeah, and it would be great if I could have, maybe if you could send me reports daily in terms of the air quality, and then again, if we can maybe get somebody in to the Emergency Operations Center from the Air Board, I can guarantee you it's a massive education. I feel like I've learned so much about what it takes to orchestrate an enormous response to a catastrophic disaster in the last 7 days. It's just been such an education, and we're so grateful for so many who have come in and helped us. And if you get a chance today, thank a first responder, because we've had firefighters and law enforcement come from, I think, every single county and almost and so many cities across California, and then also in six other states. And these people have worked at times for 32 hours straight with no sleep, and then they get relieved. And we'd be in a lot worse shape right now. At one point, I had not a mandated evacuation in my own neighborhood, but it had a advisory evacuation. And, of course, I packed up my bags like everybody else and put them in my car and then waited. The fires that ravaged the Fountain Grove area were only about less than a mile from my house. I can tell you that 121, for those of you who represent county government, 121, but I think it's going to go higher, of our employees lost their homes, including our Director of Economic Development, Director of General Services, and Director of Human Services. So the loss of homes and how it's going to affect us over the long term economically is also a dire thing. But from your perspective as the Air District, this is why we need Air Districts. We need your help. So the masks need to keep coming. There should be also, I believe, coordination with the Northern Sonoma County Air District, which I hope, Jack, that you guys are reaching out to them. I think they've got a meeting coming up. And I think they would be. It would help them. It would aid them if you could share what you guys have done to date. So with that, I will end. And Liz, if there's any directors there who want to ask me questions, I'm available.
Okay. Thanks, Shirley. I know that you need to go now, so I think what I'll do is tell people how to reach you, how to reach Michelle. Shirley's been kind enough to be on the phone with me anytime I've needed to call her in the past, the past 7 or 8 days. So, Shirley, I know this has been such a tough time, and actually we're just about to hear from Brad next, who's, I think, county is in far better shape than yours, as I understand. But we will jot the number down for people to call Michelle, who then can get through to you. And anything else you need, obviously, call Jack.
Jack and I have been on speed dial, so I really appreciate that. And I appreciate him coming up to some of the town hall meetings with staff, and that presence has been most appreciated. So thank you. And to Brad, I just want to say I'm also equally sorry, because I know there have been tremendous losses in Napa County, too. So, but we're all in this together, man. I'll tell you, you don't realize how much you depend upon your neighboring counties until you go through something like this. As far as Marin County, if Katie's there, they opened up a wonderful evacuation shelter for us. And within on Tuesday, I think there were 450 people there, mainly young Latino families that were evacuated out of the Sonoma Valley. And that has been a great assist for us because we didn't have any room left in our evacuation centers.
Wow.
Shirley, thanks so much for being on the phone.
Okay.
We will hopefully see you in person next time.
Yes.
And in the meantime, we'll circulate the phone number so that they could get a hold of Michelle and get through to you.
Okay. Great.
Thanks.
All right. Thanks
you guys. Again. Okay.
Thank
bye-bye.
You. Bye-bye.
So, Brad, you're going to take it from here.
I also want to appreciate that the Air District has been there for us all along. I also want to appreciate that I was driving with our assistant chief yesterday through one of our areas, and we ran into, you know, there are a lot of trucks out there, and I think I ran through a whole, you know, most of the little towns of Marin. We ran into most of their trucks as I was coming through, and you know, Canfield and Ross and Larkspur, all kind of in one little pod working together on taking care of this one area. And it, you know, it does make you realize that this is the family that we have of workers that come to all of our rescue and you know, people, my citizens, on occasions when we send folks to other fires, and we have folks down in Southern California, and they go, oh, why are we sending, why? And now it comes clear why we're doing that. It's mutual aid is mutual, and we work on it on both sides, and at the, you know, as when you're one of the ones on our end of the mutual, we really appreciate it, and thank you all. Before I go outside in Napa now, I put up air now because it does have the and you can put in your zip code and you get. It was 129 when I got up this morning to come in. It's 174 right now. Yeah. So it's down to 174. It was in the mid 300s at one point. You couldn't see. I was talking to our people that were out work, you know, that were out coming from all over, and I was saying, normally this is a beautiful place to look at. You can't see the hills. You couldn't see, and we're less than a mile from the hills. You couldn't see them, and it was all that particulate. The masks have been very helpful. It's the new chic in the wine country to be rocking the mask, and in consultation, and this is one of the places that it is very helpful to have a health officer for the Air District, able to talk health officer to health officer with our people. We were going to have school start today, and with that air quality, we've put off starting school until Monday. It's kind of a mixed bag for the kids. They, you know, moms and dads aren't allowing them out because the outside is where the air quality is so bad. You stay in and shelter in place, you know. You hear about the kids these days just playing video games, but when you can't go outside, it becomes a problem. We're going to have some cabin fevered kids by the end of this. We have talked about the idea that Shirley mentioned of at least having some liaison to our EOC, because that would be helpful, especially in, you know, you don't need this in earthquakes necessarily unless it starts some large event otherwise. But in this type of event, a AIR event, we need to have that conversation with AIR and have it regularly. We were talking. One of the things that's most known and understood in the Bay Area, and we've heard this over the years, is the Spare the AIR days. And you may not need to do it. We may not need to do Spare the AIR days down through. We may just need to do a sub-regional Spare the AIR day, and that kind of defines for people a little bit more what should be done and what shouldn't be done. We're going to have quite a while, unless there's a major rain come in. We're going to have the woods are going to be smoking for a while, and we're going to have particulate. And then when the cleanup happens, that dust and stuff will be stirred up into the air, and that dust is often toxic. So we're going to be dealing with this for a while. We really do appreciate everything everybody has done for us and with us, and we will be there for you when because we know catastrophes are going to continue to happen. I've been on the city council and the board of supervisors for over 30 years, and this is not the first time that we've had a disaster, but we know there's going to be more. And we appreciate that you're there for us now, and we'll be there for you in the future. Thank you.
Thanks, Brad, and thanks to Shirley as well. And would you just either text or do whatever to give them Shirley's phone number in case somebody needs to contact her?
Absolutely.
So is there anyone here who hasn't? Nate?
Yeah, I just want to say to Shirley's off the phone, but to Brad, I was on the Oakland City Council during the Oakland Hills firestorm, and I didn't think anything could top that, and you definitely, all of you have my sympathies, because, a fire of that magnitude is just colossal and unimaginable, and you're right, these types of disasters will occur. And because we're an earthquake country as well, so we expect that type of thing to occur. But the fires are frequent during this time of the year annually. And so just to think that a fire could be that devastating and that massive is, beyond my comprehension. I just didn't think anything like that would ever occur again. And I do think it's good that, we've experienced it, because I think our first responders were prepared because they've had experiences dealing with disasters of this type. And also they go through training like, we have Urban Shield that's put on that prepares our first responders to deal with disasters and be capable of prolonging their responsiveness over a prolonged period of time, 72 hours straight, et cetera. And I think that type of training is critical. So I just want to speak to my sympathies and definitely condolences to all the people who lost lives, but all the people who have lost property as well. It's going to have its psychological toll, and there's going to be implications that are not necessarily foreseen at the moment, but will arise down the road. But hang in there.
Thanks, Nate. I would be willing to bet that every one of you here have sent some kind of fire engine, first responder, whatever it is. I know that ours went from Palo Alto, so I'm sure they've gone from every other city in town. Yeah. So with that, Jack, I want to give you a chance to actually do your presentation, but okay. I really appreciate hearing from Shirley and Brad, who I know you were on the front lines.
Mm-hmm. So, Madam Chair, members of the board, let me hand it back over to Wayne Keno, who will walk you through the steps that we took, how it was done, and lessons learned for the future as well.
Thank you, Jack. So I will go over what we did, what we tried to do, how we came to what we did, and try and you know, provide some information on how we can improve in the future, which is very important to us. So in this presentation, I just wanted to go over a little bit of how we discover things, what our response objectives are, give you a little summary of the fires. We'll then have Judy Catino, our health officer, talk about the health effects of smoke, which is very important. It was very pertinent to this situation. We'll have Eric Stevenson go over the air monitoring and air quality information. Lisa Fasano go over the community and media information, and then I'll try and summarize all the information at the end here. But again, you know, because of the number of people who are speaking here, it's a small amount of people, but there's so many people in the air district that helped in this, all the executive staff and you guys too. So I just wanted to make sure I said that. So anytime we get any sort of incident, we get notified, and there's numerous ways we get notified. Some of our staff could see it. We get complaints. Emergency response agencies call us. Media, we get a lot from the media because they have helicopters flying around all the time, traffic helicopters. So we get a lot of information that way. Facilities notify us immediately. Also, they require, some of them are required. And in Contra Costa, we have the community alert system, the CARE system, which does the sirens, does the call-outs on the phones, texts all of us here about what has happened, and we can respond to that fairly quickly. Our response objectives, I think this is an extremely important slide, is that our first response for Air District is to support the first responders. There's a fine line between interfering with what they do and then just trying to help them and provide information that we can to them that would be helpful for them to respond. And the one example I use is that there was a fire in a small facility, I believe it was on our border of Fairfield and Vacaville in our area, and the fire department that responded didn't have a lot of equipment other than just normal firefighting equipment. We brought our infrared camera. We were able to tell them what tanks were full, what tanks were empty. We had our permitting information to tell them what was in the tanks so that we could help them respond to that to that situation. So we do provide that. We just try and help out the best we can all the time, trying to not interfere with the first responders. So it's a fine line, and we try and walk that line, and we're very good at that. We try and gather information. We try to identify the source, stop the emissions. That's really number one for us. Gather information for the community impacts and equipment, determine what resources we need to deploy. In this case, we deployed additional monitoring. Conduct sampling, modeling, lab analysis to determine where, you know, the emissions went, the plume, what the affected areas could possibly be, and we coordinate our efforts with all the relevant agencies. So this is a map of the fires. I think this was as of Tuesday morning. I'm sorry I didn't get to update it. But, you know, over 245,000 acres in the state of California has burned. That's a tremendous amount of acreage. Over 150,000 just in this area. 1,000 acres burned, 6 fires on this map that people are fighting, have impacted all these areas tremendously, and the smoke impacts have been tremendous. 5,700 structures, more than 5,700 structures are gone, and over 34,000 people have been displaced. So it's a massive event, something that we have not seen before. As Director Miley had said, we had responded to the Oakland Hills fire. We responded to the San Bruno fire, provided information that we're falling on those to help us and trying to determine what additional things we can bring to this effort, because there is still the cleanup effort that's left too, and still the impacts from what's going on right now. So with that, I will be talking at just a little bit about the fire timeline. I put this first bullet on there because Sunday afternoon there was a small fire at a wrecking yard in Napa. It was a grass fire that went into this wrecking yard. Actually, Jack was the first one that notified us. He saw it from San Francisco. Our standby staff responded. So we're out in the area on Sunday evening, actually, still responding and trying to figure out what was going on. And that Sunday evening, about 10 o'clock, that's when all the 911 centers were flooded with calls. I mean, the winds picked up, the fires started burning, and by Monday morning, there were over 20 fires burning in California. So it was a quick event. continues today. So it's been more than a week. And on Monday morning, because of that initial fire, and we had already deployed, and we had been talking to both our Met Division, our meteorology Eric's group, and Lisa's group, we were able to respond fairly quickly with smoke advisories, health advisories for the Bay Area. So I would say that, since we do have that standby crew on hand, we were able to respond fairly quickly. But there's more we can do, and we'll discuss that later on in this presentation. So I think it's Judy Catino up next with some smoke facts.
Thank you, Wayne.
Thanks, Wayne.
Chairperson Ness and members of the board, good morning. So smoke is composed of a mixture of particulate matter in a wide range of sizes, combined with various organic gases and inorganic gases. The primary pollutant that we focus on is the very fine particulate matter. Healthy individuals exposed to smoke may experience an array of temporary symptoms, such as stinging eyes, runny nose, scratchy throat. The irritation to airway and lungs can cause coughing, wheezing, chest tightness, and general difficulty breathing. Smoke presents the greatest health threat to those with lung and cardiovascular disease, older adults, pregnant women, and children. Even short-term exposures to very high concentrations of fine particulate can aggravate lung disease, provoke asthma, exacerbate bronchitis, and it may also increase the susceptibility to respiratory infections. In people with cardiovascular disease, short-term exposure has been shown to increase the risk of heart attack and stroke. So to reduce exposure, it's recommended first to stay indoors with windows and doors closed. If available, running the air conditioner on recirculate is advised, or if practical, create a clean room in the house using a freestanding indoor air HEPA filter. The ozone generators, which are sometimes incorporated in some air cleaners, are not advised. Avoid outdoor activities, including exercise and sports. The higher respiratory rate and deep breathing can drive the particulate very deep into the lungs. Avoid indoor activities that compromise indoor air, vacuuming, gas stoves, candles. If the indoor air is still causing irritation, it's advised to seek a location outside that has filtered air-conditioned air, such as perhaps a library or a mall. If outdoors for a prolonged period, an N95 particulate mask offers some protection, but it's very important to wear the mask properly and to secure it around the nose and mouth so the air, so it's actually able to filter. And finally, to avoid activities that contribute to the ambient air pollution and spare the air. Now, Eric Stevenson, our Director of Meteorology and Measurement, will continue.
Thank you, Judy. Good morning, Chair.
Thanks very much. Welcome.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair Ness, members of the board. I'll give you an update of some of the air quality impacts that we saw from these fires and give you an idea of how we've been providing information not only to Lisa and her group for dissemination widely, but to specific entities that requested our assistance. So on Sunday evening, there were numerous wildfires that were reported in both Sonoma and Napa County, as Wayne said.
and the air became unhealthy quite quickly, not only in those areas, but throughout the Bay Area. One of the issues with this particular fire, these particular fires, was that the smoke plumes were very narrow, very tightly packed, and so what we saw, at least at the beginning of the fires, was that air quality conditions changed quite rapidly. You could be in one area and the smoke impacts would be quite noticeable, and then 10 or 15 minutes as the wind direction changed and that narrow plume moved away from the area, the air quality improved significantly. So we saw highly variable impacts throughout the Bay Area. We did our best to update our forecasts on a regular basis, and I'll talk about that a little bit later in the next slide. And we provided these updates to any of the partners that requested that as time went on. So we've been adding to this list over time. In fact, we just sent updates to Director Zane so that she has this information also. So in addition to the 16 permanent stations that we have located throughout the Bay Area that measure PM2.5, we worked with our state partner, the California Air Resources Board, to deploy additional resources in the fire areas. As Wayne had pointed out initially, our first concern is to make sure that we're not causing additional issues for the first responders. So we have just recently located an additional monitor in Santa Rosa. We have located monitors in Roanoke Park, Petaluma, Napa in the south of Napa, and Cordelia. And you can see from this map, what we tried to do was ring this fire area as much as possible with these temporary monitors to aid us in providing information to impacted communities downwind as these winds continue to push that smoke down into the Bay Area and have significant impacts throughout. You'll see the little picture there of the temporary monitors that were placed in these areas. And then, of course, we used our permanent monitoring stations to provide information throughout the Bay Area about what those fire impacts were throughout the Nine Bay Area region. So as we've heard and as we've all felt, these fires had some pretty significant impacts throughout the Bay Area, not just in the North counties. And we've seen, this is a chart of what the AQI, or the representation of air quality throughout the Bay Area, was during this time period. We've seen colors we've never seen before here in the Bay Area. You'll see that, in particular, the North Bay saw very unhealthy levels, levels that, as Director Nis pointed out, were things that folks in Beijing see from time to time when they're having their worst air quality. So it was quite impactful. And you'll also see a lot of red, which indicates unhealthy, and that was spread throughout the Bay Area during these time periods, particularly on Friday the 13th, where the smoke and the wind direction kind of filled the basin, and we saw those impacts particularly around the Bay Area Rim and in the North Bay counties. You'll also notice that there's a lot of NAs here. We were asked to add in the information that was provided by the temporary monitors that were located in these areas, and those white areas are actually a lot of the results that we didn't start seeing until we were bringing these monitors up. Getting this information from the monitors is difficult. We have to uplink to satellites in order to get the information in, so we were working with ARB to ensure that we were getting this data on a regular basis. And you can see that we haven't yet started seeing the data from Santa Rosa yet. We expect to start seeing that information today. You'll also notice that...
Do you have today's up already? I noticed this goes through Monday.
We weren't able to update this slide this morning, but I do have the forecast on what is going to happen, and I'll provide
And you're
that.
Going to tell everyone how to get it anyway, right?
Yes, yes. You'll also notice that...
Eric, could you point out the Santa Rosa temporary, that's the EBAM, right? That's from the state. Those are the ones that they came in and gave us... Whereas ours were already going ahead and recording. So
Exactly. So the whites were the temporary monitors that were brought in by the California Air Resources Board. You'll also notice that we missed some information on Tuesday at one of our Napa sites. That was caused by the loss of electrical power and communications. We had some of our staff go up and correct that so that we were able to start collecting data again. And then you'll also notice that there's some missing data in Redwood City and in San Jose and San Jose near Roadway. We were performing maintenance on those particular instruments, and once the fire became known to us, we stopped that maintenance and got those instruments back online. So just how bad were the impacts here? This chart gives you an idea comparing what we saw during these devastating fires compared to some of the worst air quality we've seen prior to these fires. And you can see that in the cases that are in light blue there are days in which the impacts were from normal Bay Area days compared to the dark purple where we saw the impacts from the fires. And you can see that there is a significant difference between those two, and that these fires created some very, very unhealthy levels, particularly in the North Bay, but throughout the Bay Area again. And I want to say that these were the highest readings that we saw throughout the Bay Area. So this doesn't necessarily represent what the concentrations were in any given area, but were the highest for the Bay Area on that day. You'll see that the days in which we saw impacts that weren't associated with the fire were mostly associated with holidays in which folks are home and burning in their fireplaces. You'll also notice that most of those days occurred prior to the adoption of our wood smoke regulations, with the exception of December in 2013. That was a very dry year, if you'll recall. So now I'll pass the microphone
Eric,
on.
One question, Madam Chair, that we got during the executive committee was, could we compare that chart to the Oakland fire?
Right.
And we weren't monitoring for PM 2.5.
Right.
Do you want to mention
Certainly.
That?
So during the Oakland firestorm, we weren't, measurement of PM 2.5 was brand new. The federal program had just come online, so we didn't have these capabilities when that firestorm occurred. So we don't have those comparators for you. One of the other things that I wanted to point out is that we did provide a lot of information to sporting events, places where we knew that large numbers of people were going to gather. We worked with Cal football. We worked with Stanford football. We worked with the Oakland Raiders and the Golden State Warriors to ensure that the air quality in those venues or near those venues was going to be that those facilities knew what those impacts were so that they could make those decisions. We strive to provide those folks that requested information about what those impacts might be, how they relate, and of course those venues then take action based on that information.
Did any of them actually cancel the games?
No, but I will say that Cal football was very close to canceling that Friday night game because the levels were elevated, and we were providing that information to them and others on an hourly basis. So we were providing hourly forecasts from Friday through the weekend so that folks who were doing those events had up to the hour information about what was going on, so that they might take adequate action, not only to protect their student athletes, but to protect the large numbers of the public that might be gathering.
Thanks so much.
Good morning, Chair Ness and members of the board. So what have we been talking about for the past week and a half? Well, we've been talking about the fires, as you know, and we developed very quickly some brief active talking points to kind of hone in what our messages are and just repeat those over and over to let people know how to protect themselves, where they could go for smoke information, and what they could do if they found themselves in smoky conditions. We focused specifically on our air district expertise. There was a lot of information we could have been sharing at this time, but we focused on specifically what it was that we are doing to assist and the information that we can make available to the public. we responded quickly. We had calls coming in immediately on Monday, which was a holiday, all the way through the week, the weekend. And we've had a team of communicators who've been talking to the media and getting information out regularly. Social media for this event really helped us get information out much further, and I'll show you some stats later. But we were able to put quick messages up and get those pushed out and pushed out much further, much more quickly than we were through other means of getting information out. We stayed in our lane through this entire messaging event. We talked about air quality and how you protect yourself, and that's where we left it. There was lots of other information that was being shared with us that could have been shared, but it was important for us to maintain our credibility, to stay in our lane with the information that we knew best. And we worked very closely with the broader team here, the communications folks, the web team, meteorology, compliance and enforcement, our health officer, Judy. We all worked very effectively. We've been in constant communication, which has helped us reframe our talking points as we've moved along, address new issues that have come up, and get that information out to the public. So this is what it's been looking like over the past week. We had more than over 200 media calls from local, regional, and national media. We were getting calls from Good Morning America to CBS National News, really from everyone. We've taken over 500 public calls on our public information line, and we were fortunate to bring in some additional help into our office to help address all these questions. Just where do we go for the information? Can you walk me through how to read it? We got calls from school districts and public health nurses and high schools and colleges and athletic departments, as Eric had mentioned. So we've been trying to walk everyone through the health information that we've got, the air district information, and where they can go for additional resources if they were looking for those. I mentioned our social media stats. You can see that on Facebook this week we reached over 102,000 hits pushing out our messages broader, and over 632,000 retweets of messages we put out on Twitter. So we were really able to expand our messaging through our air district social media uses. Instagram was something. People were putting up pictures. We put up four pictures. One included the N95 mask, and that was shared more than 2,400 times and was liked and pushed out even further. And through this incident, we were able to expand our Facebook and Twitter followers so that people are staying in touch with the air district now, keeping on top of what's happening with air quality. So I'm really proud of our communications team. It continues to be a bit of a tough haul to get all this information out, but they've been doing a great job, and we've been keeping those messages crisp and short and to the point, and I think that people are getting the information that they need. Now I'd like to turn it back over to Wayne.
Thanks so much. I really appreciate the report and the slides and the succinctness as well.
Okay. Actually, there's just one more thing I wanted to add. So our web pages, we've received over 1.2 million page views on the web pages for the Air District this week, as the web team has been able to put up that information and make it a little bit more broader than what we normally have posted. We had over 1.2 million hits. Normally, we have about 4,000 page views a day. So that, during the fires, that went to over 250,000 page views a day. So people were accessing our air quality information. We had banners across the top that gave people easy links in, and they were to get they were able to get that information more quickly. Unfortunately, on a couple of occasions, the site went down, or AirNow went down, but it was because of the volume of traffic that we were seeing on both of those sites, and we were able to quickly make those changes and get the information back up. And then we've also had nearly a million page views on sparetheair.org this week, also trying to avail that health information, the air quality information. So people have been using the website and getting the information.
So I'm going to try and summarize this in a few slides here. So, you know, we've given you the air monitoring, the monitoring and air quality data, the communication impacts that we had, you know, just tremendous effort from all the people involved. Aiding the first responders. So, you know, our staff, as we talked about this incident as unfolding, you know, it was sort of a helpless feeling. I mean, we're accustomed to something like a facility fire or something going on in a refinery. We could respond to those kinds of things, and we kind of know how to do that. But in this case, you know, it was a widespread. You know, if you're in a single dwelling fire or a business fire, you could go upwind, you can escape. We can give the health messages to the people downwind, and there are remedies that could happen. In this particular one, you know, people couldn't escape. They were in the fire. They're in the fire area. So all of us got together. We started to try and brainstorm what could we do. We sort of felt helpless here. So the idea came from multiple sources, but we talked about these masks and try to distribute as many as we can, as quickly as we can. And that first day, I think we distributed over 20,000 masks initially. We took advantage of our relationships with our safety vendors. We tried to get these masks from out of this county, out of state, because we didn't want to impact the supply in these areas, because people were going to stores to try and buy them. We didn't want to impact that. So we went out of state and we went out of the counties. We went into, God, I forgot where it was, down in the valley, Patterson, picked up quite a few there. People drove out there, brought them back. And so we just had a tremendous effort. We had a command center for us up in our Napa office. And we started to try and visit the emergency centers, the escape centers. And our staff, you know, I can't say enough about our staff. They just don't drop off things. They talk to the people there to try and figure out where else can we be of help. Because as we drop these first wave of masks off, you know, those centers become, you know, they have enough masks for the time being. So they started asking these people at these centers, you know, where else can we provide these? So we started providing them to senior centers. They provided us with addresses, to farm workers, trying to get it out to people who are working in the fields. We hit a lot of places, and if you look at this distribution list, I think is at your stations there, you'll see the kinds of places we went to. We delivered all these things, all these masks, and I think that all our staff did just a tremendous job of trying to get them where they are needed and quickly. We have ordered additional 40,000 masks that we have to get them, and they're going to take a while to get here because we've sort of depleted the whole area. And it's where we've tried to procure more, and we are getting those. I don't know when they come, but hopefully sometime this week.
So, Madam Chair, a number of board members have asked for masks. So what we will do is we'll circle back with all of you by email and or text and get you them as soon as we can, because a number of board members have asked for them.
Thank you. I know this was going above and beyond to get that many masks. Just to ask the obvious, did you ask Amazon and so forth?
We ordered from Amazon initially too.
And they ran out?
Yeah, we ordered about 5,000 from them. We had them delivered to people's homes, our staff homes. So we did that also, but we also took advantage of some of our safety vendors, mostly to get these. Yeah. The fire cleanup is extremely important. We have experience from the Oakland Hills fire, from the San Bruno fire. With this hazardous materials, we have jurisdiction over asbestos removals. We have to use a common sense approach. We try and provide for people's safety. We work with the DTSC and all the other agencies, so we're sort of trying to get that plan for that, to make sure that everyone goes back safely. We don't want people walking around the ash without protection, trying to get their valuables, and getting exposed. So that's a great concern to us. And however, we will try and expedite everything that we can do. For instance, we got a call from, I believe, the San Rosa Kmart. There are emergency situations where parts of that store are still standing and it's in danger of falling on people and so forth. So they've asked for permission to go ahead and remove walls that potentially have asbestos in them. And of course, we gave them that permission. So as Jack had talked to you too, and from every incident that we have, we try and do a lessons learned. We try and improve. We try for this continuous improvement. And this was an unusual one. So, you know, we haven't debriefed yet, but we came up with a few sort of topics that we want to talk to about. We're still exploring ways that we can improve. But we're still in the middle of this also, so it's a little difficult, but we'll try and communicate some of these things. So communication is one of them. We talked with some of you, Director Wagon Connect in particular. He talked about, for instance, that his whole communication system up in Napa went down. No cell phones, no internet, no anything. So how do you communicate messages to people out in those areas? So we're going to be exploring that with emergency response agencies to try and get some messages out. How do we do that? Do we take advantage of local radio stations that are still broadcasting issues, things like that? So we have a number of things we want to do here. How do we get information out in different languages? Because, you know, some of these areas that we experienced, there were no English speakers. So, you know, and they're afraid of government also. So to get the types of aid that we want to get out to these people, we need to improve that, and we're going to explore all those options here. You know, the communication of air quality impacts to all the affected parties during extraordinary events, that's key here. You know, Eric had talked about some of the schools called us, school districts, venues. We had all kinds of calls trying to ask for information from us, and we can provide the information, but you realize when people are asking for information, there's different levels of expertise here. We get some health professionals, but we get the common person who doesn't know anything about air quality, so we have to structure our messaging so that we can talk to all levels. At least this group does a tremendous job of doing that, and we just need to improve that and try and accommodate that. Response. We have talked about developing specialized incident response teams for these kinds of issues because there are more, as some of you have said, there's more of these kinds of events coming in the future. You know, unfortunately, they are going to be coming. So we need to try and develop maybe some specialized teams to deal with fires, to deal with earthquakes, to deal with other kinds of events that might happen. So we're going to be exploring that, getting emergency supplies to our field offices so that we can quickly deploy things like masks, like respirators, other types of things. So we'll be exploring that also. And in the Executive Council meeting, they talked about relationships. We do a pretty good job with the federal and the state agencies, but we don't do, you know, an adequate job, in my view, because I'm the response guy, with the local communities, the local agencies, the emergency response agencies, the health departments. So we need to strengthen those relationships and make sure that we have built those prior to these things happening. I'm involved in the state committee for refinery safety, and part of that whole group is developing those relationships, knowing who to call when something happens. So I think that on a local level, we need to do that countywide, citywide, whatever we need to do to try and develop those relationships and get those numbers and names so we can call each other. And there's more to come, obviously. We haven't finished this, and we're going to continue to explore what we need to explore with input from everyone that we can. And this cleanup is just starting. We are sending people out this morning in terms of for asbestos removals to try and at those locations where the DTSC is sitting along with the other local agencies to help people get back into their homes or their areas where their homes were. With that, we'd be happy to answer any questions you have. And I wanted to show you the number of staff that was involved. So I think I miss people, but the number of people that just volunteered, responded, was tremendous. All the way from ordering things for us, purchase orders, you know, to actually going out and talking to people, distributing masks, doing forecasting. It was a lot of people. So this is just some of our staff, and I didn't involve any of these people or myself.
I'm going to talk to you about that later. But no, of course not.
It's very impressive. It really is. Yes. Great job. So there are some questions. I have to start out Rebecca, then Director Kim, then Scott.
Thank you. First of all, just really thank you. It is really impressive, the response that folks here have done, and also thank you for the masks. We were able to get some of them and share them with both some of our staff who work outside, as well as with some senior centers and some of the homeless encampments as well, where, you know, go indoors only works if you have an indoors. You know, I also think it really reinforces that we are one region. You know, and it was Sunday night, the first Sunday night of the fire. I woke up in the middle of the night thinking that the building probably next door to me was on fire because it smelled that strong, and it was about 100 miles away. And, you know, we really are that intertwined, and it's a good reminder. And appreciate, I know one of our fire crews was up there from Oakland, and I know from many of the others as well. And so I think it just reinforces the importance of our regional collaboration. I wanted to just make a couple of suggestions. One, I want to make sure we follow up on Director Zane's requests for more mass there, for a liaison for their EOC, you know, the specific requests that were already made. I just want to make sure those don't get forgotten in our discussion. That seems really important, and certainly my deep appreciation and condolences to those who are directly living in it, and as well as all of us breathing it. I also appreciate the suggestion of having, you know, our own emergency supplies available. I really think we need to do that. I don't know if you need more action from the board to make that happen or not, but I think, you know, an extra supply of masks to have available. I think we all know that with the level of global warming that, you know, these type of incidents, this is not expected to be the last one. And so I think it would be a good idea for us to have both, you know, the generic sort of earthquake kit type supplies of water and flashlights and all that in each of our facilities, but also extra supplies of masks to have around so that we're ready for such incidents. I also just wanted to make a couple of suggestions around helping jurisdictions have the good air filtration in buildings that are used in these types of cases. So when we say, okay, go to a library or go to a senior center and those facilities will have clean air, I'd like us to look into some way that probably we could get bulk discount rates for the good filtration devices and work in partnership with our local jurisdictions so that we should, with the goal of having throughout the region some libraries or schools or centers designated in each of our communities as being ones where we have good air filtration, and if some communities don't have good air filtration in those buildings, maybe a project that we can help organize to get good filtration put into public buildings in each area so that every area does have public buildings with good air filtration that people can be told to go to when there are air quality problems. And then I also wanted to ask about, I emailed everybody the web link for the Google Mobile Air Pollution Monitoring Project. And when an incident happens, obviously we've got our permanent monitors in various locations, but I'd like us to look into either our own or in partnership with the existing Google project for us to have, they just have it mounted on the top of a small passenger car, and so if there is a concern in a particular location, they can just drive to that location. They don't need to figure out where to plug it in because it's powered off the car. And I think that would be something that would behoove us to either have or have a partnership with some company where we can deploy it to a specific location when there's a particular need, and that you don't need to have electricity working in that location for it to work. And also, Director Zane had requested to be coordinating with their local medical director. I just realized I had that in my notes as well. And then my last suggestion is when we issue our alerts, both for a specific incident, but also our Winter Spare the Air program in general, that we add about not burning recreational fires, backyard fires. We have a lot of information about your fireplace, which is great, and I'm glad we're doing that. And when we get to that item, I'll talk about, you know, ways to strengthen the fireplace change-out program. But there's also been people burning just fires in their backyard just kind of for fun, and they don't necessarily realize that that's part of what we're talking about when we say don't burn, because all of our imagery is around specifically fireplaces. And so I think we should be incorporating that. Also, because recreational backyard fires can get out of control, and the last thing you want when you have a huge fire problem is to have firefighters called away to put out a fire you start in your backyard because you were just burning stuff for entertainment. So those are my thoughts, and greatly appreciate being part of this collaborative. Thanks.
Thanks, Rebecca. I have now Director Kims, Haggerty, Sink, in that order.
Yeah, my comments build off of Director Kaplan's
really impressive overview of the past 8 days. And I think as Director Miley has said, reminded us, this isn't the first time we've had such a major fire, but it sounds as though this could be the sort of signature event that helps us to up our game, both as an air district and as a 9-county region with lots of cities. And so if coming out of this, we're able to come up with a sort of bulletproof plan that is just on autopilot, that'd be fantastic. I was blown away. I mean, when we first got the notice about the availability of these things, I thought that those masks would be available to us at the local level down in San Mateo County on the following Monday, but they arrived within 2 hours. And I know Supervisor Canepa and me and maybe Supervisor Groom in San Mateo County were able to get these things out in advance of the weekend. So hats off. My one comment, a couple comments. As the district figures out what's the best way to alert the public and help support our public, you have 24 force multipliers here, as you know. And so I'm curious about what the process will be, as Wayne said, for taking lessons learned and figuring out a multi-pronged game plan. Will the board have an opportunity? Because I know I'm one of 24 people up here that has a lot of ideas. So that's one question. Getting information out, and Lisa talked about this, I struggled, and maybe I'm the exception here, with how to translate the messaging that was coming from the district and pumping it out to my folks. And whether it's social media or next door, it seems like that is like the currency that a lot of people get information from. I know that there's a lot of consideration about that, but if you could help us as board members help the district by figuring out how to get out messages from different social media platforms, that would be fantastic. A couple other thoughts, building off of what Director Kaplan said. Is there a shelf life to these things? Because if not, why don't we stock up on these when there isn't a crisis? Right. And, you know, I'm amazed by how many delivery locations district got out to, but y'all shouldn't have to have 50 cars out there driving to all these centers. Maybe as part of the future plan, there's a way to work through the county supervisors and the cities and maybe the members of the board to get them out to our cities and the first responders so that we can eliminate the middleman, so that you guys don't have to have all these delivery vehicles coming from the district. So if we can stock up on these, that would be great. And again, kudos to everybody.
Okay. Supervisor Haggerty.
That is our plan, by the way, is to stock up, Director Kim.
You're up.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I want to, when you put up the staff acknowledgement, and I know Jack said we'll talk about it later, I want to acknowledge Jack because my first call to Jack was when I got a call from the NFL saying we need to talk to somebody about air quality because they weren't sure what they were going to do about the game that was coming up at the Coliseum on Sunday. And Jack immediately took a conference call with the NFL and started working with them. So I wanted to first thank him on that. It's not always easy to take a phone call from me because not that my name shows up when it comes up, but
that it does.
My number comes up blocked, so you don't know what you're getting. And I called Jack on a Sunday night because I was actually at a house with a woman that was pregnant that lives in Forestville up in Sonoma. And she had been staying at my sister-in-law's home, and they were debating whether or not to go home and that night. And although Jack gave her information that actually made her cry, she elected not to go home that night. And I don't think she has still gone home. And I think that was great information that you gave her, knowing that she's 7 months pregnant and asthmatic. But I want to thank you for, you know, taking the phone call on a Sunday night, giving, you know, somebody that lives in Sonoma County the information that they needed to make that baby healthy. And, you know, along those lines, There was a CNN article that came out on Twitter dated the 16th that said air pollution may shorten your lives while you're pregnant, the baby's lives during pregnancy. And it seems to me that, you know, if that article is true, that maybe the Air District should be putting out some sort of health advisory to pregnant women up in that area that, you know, you may want to think about this, and you may want to leave the area. I don't want to, you know, cause a hysteria, but when you start talking about particulate matter and being in the bloodstream and things like that, maybe this is not something we want to be doing with, you know, young growing infants. That may be something we want to think of. So as far as the air mass, again, great idea. I happen to be here for a meeting on Friday, so I was able to take some with me. We actually had a pop-up event in Livermore, which was quite successful. We had people that were actually waiting for us when we got there, and people were very thankful. And I don't know how many people would look at it and go, oh, the N95s, the good ones. They said that repeatedly, and we got rid of about 300 in Livermore, and the ones that we didn't get rid of, we sent up to Forestville in Sonoma. So they were all put to good use, and I do want to thank the Air District for doing that. Of course, on Monday we got a call from a senior center saying, how do we get the leftovers, and we had to report there were no leftovers, but I don't know if my staff has been in contact with you on it, but I told them who to call. But I do want to thank the Air District. It's been a great experience. I grieve for the people who have passed away, those that are missing. It's a horrible event. 5,700 homes lost. The rebuilding is going to take years, if not decades. As a community, we'll all pull together. We'll pull together for the North counties, and we'll help them just as they've helped us.
Okay. Director Sinks, then Cutter, but let me first ask, is there more staff report? Okay.
Rod. Thank you. Well, we all stand in solidarity with the North County, not only now in the disaster, but going forward. I think this is going to, it's going to take 2 years or more to rebuild. People speculate, and I think we all have to be sensitive to the fact that long after the fires have died down, we're all going to have to figure out how to help the North County help rebuild their livelihoods and economy. And maybe that's not a direct part of what the Air District does, but I think all of us in local government ought to be thinking about ways we can stand in solidarity with the North County. North counties in our district. I really appreciated hearing about the Air District's efforts, the things that we've done, being able to help first responders, firefighters with IR imaging and the knowledge of the permits of what's in tanks. I mean, that's got to be really critical. So I'd really like to express appreciation for that. I'd like to express appreciation for the Air District employee who came by my house Friday late afternoon and delivered air masks that subsequently have gone to the Cupertino Senior Center. And I've gotten reports that a whole variety of folks from various West Valley cities have come to the Senior Center, people with asthma and heart and lung conditions. So thank you for that. I have a technical question, which is, for those who continue to live day after day in highly impacted places, you know, I've had a comment and question from some that have picked up these masks that, you know, is there something even better that might have an exit valve on it, or is there a recommendation? And a technical question about whether this filters PM10, PM2.5, and how effective for those. Yeah, for particulate matter. How much is this thing filtering out, assuming there's a good seal, which I understand is the most critical factor?
Right. We do.
So, Director Sinks, these masks are 95% efficient at removing particles at 0.3 microns or greater. So they're pretty good. There are available respirators that are the next step in protection. However, they need to be fit accordingly, and they do because of the way they have to be worn. A lot of times folks have to go through a medical surveillance test. So, you know, it's the next step up, but there's some complications with that also.
And finally, are there recommendations for folks who are walking into fields of ashes where there may be toxins and other things? How does one make sure their health is protected as they go into these places where there could have been lots of toxins that burned up and are still?
Could I address your previous question? It really is much more recommended to try to be inside and clean the air in the room versus relying on the mask. You know, the masks don't necessarily fit children. They were designed for workers. So that's kind of important. It's an investment to get HEPA filters. I think if there's public places that have or can have filtered air, that's really a better idea than masks. But the masks have been really valuable, given that so many people are outside and don't have any choice.
Yeah, as a universal type of device to wear, that is probably the best advice we give, is that particular mask that we bought. You know, our staff are all fit tested with respirators. They can wear scuba gear. They can do all those things, but that does require specialized training and specialized fit, different kinds of masks for the individual. So I think this provides the best protection that we can do universally, you know, across, yeah, on a short-term basis.
The last person to have a question is Ms. Cutter. Am I correct?
Okay, thank you. I too wanted to thank the Air District. I was out of the country and I came home Sunday night, and over in Europe it was just a little blur, but coming here, and getting texts from my family and the devastation. All of my kids went to Sonoma State, so there's a lot of friends and so forth that are up there. One of the things you have is a lot of community people who want to get involved, but they don't have that access. I did send Shirley a little blurb saying that if they ever have any organized cleanups where you could have laymen come up and do something like that, you know, that would be the time to get cities involved that aren't directly involved, because people do want to help. Piggybacking off of the Nextdoor comment, Nextdoor was exploding with questions and, you know, rumors and so forth. And I don't know if there's a direct way that the air quality can get into the Nextdoors, because that would be a horrendous task, I think, or maybe just getting to this each city or county to get to their information officer, who could then post these things on Nextdoor.
We're working on trying to create a connection with Nextdoor. The challenge we've had so far is we've wanted to do it regionally, and they work on a city by city, or they can do a county by county, but they don't have a regional basis. But they are working on a fix for that, and so we're looking at ways that we can get in, and this would be a time when, even if we can get in specific neighborhoods, yeah, that would be what we would want to do. But we've been working with Nextdoor to try to strengthen that so we can get those messages out that way.
When we tried
directly
to do
from
it
us.
City.
Yes.
It was, you know, hit and miss and so forth. And so
what we did see on Nextdoor was that we did have city public information officers that were posting our health advisory on their Nextdoor for their city. So, I mean, it was a little clunky way to get it out there, but it was moving.
No, and that's how we did it in San Leandro. And then the other is we have our disaster council meets for our city 4 times a year. And I would just think, you know, we think that we have everybody involved, but this is another whole layer that we've not involved. And so perhaps getting out to some of those, you know, in particular our council, to kind of let know what services are available, and just that constant communication. So that's something we'll contact you about, but thank you.
Thank you, Chair. First, I want to thank Jack for his efforts, and the whole staff should be very proud of how we
our role amongst many roles in the Bay Area was very exemplary and very proud of to be associated with the district. On the masks, I think that was excellent that the staff really went overboard to get them out. And with Director of Communications Fasano on many stations, you know, saying exactly what type of masks were the ones to be using was very critical in people getting to know which ones were critical. In the going forward, yeah, getting masks from the Air District, I think, would be important. But it's also a regional, something we can collaborate with the Bay Area Regional Collaborative about, because these could have information printed on them, along with our logo, of course, and maybe a radio station. You know, many cities have emergency AM radio stations. That could be an asset to be used in communications, because lo and behold, in this day and age, transistor radios may become a useful tool, especially crank ones. And as for Director Sink's question, which wasn't answered in the aftermath of his question, there probably ought to be consideration of the Air District putting out some type of layperson's MSDS, material safety data sheet, as to how you deal with walking through your property when it's laden with toxic ash. What are the best practices? Do you wet it down? What are the things that the common homeowner or person could understand what to do in those cases, and accompanied with a mask, does a mask help? What other remedies or mitigation procedures can you readily effectuate if you're just a layperson? I mean, contractors know what to do, but there's just so many people that are going to be traipsing around. Maybe we can do something like that. Again, thank you for your great efforts.
You're welcome. And I'm sorry to answer the question about the ash, but in the case of San Bruno, they declared the whole area hazardous waste site, and they did the appropriate cleanup of all the ash, treating it as hazardous materials. So I suspect that that may happen here in terms of groups of homes or whatever. And we work with those agencies that are doing that. Again, I said our jurisdiction is on the asbestos side of things in terms of removal of that. I could tell you what we did in San Bruno and other places is that where there is obvious signs of asbestos piping that's still standing that has insulation material around it, we required contractors to go in there, remove that first, because that's an easy thing to do, and then take care of the ash later on with everything else. So there's sort of a common sense approach that people use when dealing with these kinds of things. But the overall issue is just sort of declaring that whole area, all the ash, hazardous materials.
Let us also, if you don't mind, Madam Chair, Director Ross, on your point, and I think Director Singh's point, let us think about putting something out, actually being part of our overall communication to the public on just this very point, on steps to take to ensure your health is protected as you move through what your unfortunate situation is in terms of your home.
Director Kim?
Yeah, along those lines, I've actually gotten a couple questions from people saying, hey, can I reuse these? And now that we've got tens of thousands of these out there, can you tell us, I know it's probably not a black and white answer, should people throw these away? At some point, do they become harmful to your health if you keep using them over and over again?
The recommendations of the mask are basically throw them away once you use them once. That is the recommendation, is throw them away as soon as you use them. I know that what my staff has experienced when they do use these things in some cases is that as you use them, you know, they're effective 95%, right? But as they get clogged up a little bit and harder to breathe, they actually are a little bit more effective than 95. But they say once you remove them, you should probably throw them away. That's the recommendation. But, you know, better than nothing is what I would say.
I mean, that kind of messaging is helpful, because if you have 4 or 5 days of smoky weather, on that fifth day, are you actually breathing in worse air than...
No, probably.
It's still better than nothing.
It's probably better than nothing. But then again, that seal is important. I think that's what we're talking about, that it doesn't seal as effectively.
Particularly if you have hair on your face.
Yeah, if you have hair on your face, it doesn't seal.
Doesn't seal as well.
A lot of people, when they do fit testing, they put Vaseline all over their face.
Also, I think if you contaminate the inside of the mask, that's not good.
Oh, dear. We'll skip that and go on to the next. I think we have... Did anyone else on this side wish to speak or on this side that I might have missed? And if not, I believe we have a speaker from the public. Am I right, Marcy? Okay.
Jed Holtzman.
Thank you, Chairness and Directors, and I'm glad that the trials and tribulations of bearded individuals have finally made it into this room. I would just... senior policy analyst for 350 Bay Area, San Francisco resident. I would like to, you know, I was up in Sonoma on Sunday night when the fire started for a concert and kind of fled through the insane windstorm, which was exceptionally eerie and disturbing. And when I woke up the next morning to see how bad everything had gotten, I was not surprised because what I experienced up there was, I mean, I'm from Houston, and I've been through hurricanes, and that was basically like a hurricane. So it was really terrifying. Unfortunately, and it's my role, I talked about this a little bit at the executive committee, it's my role to be a downer and remind you that this is not an isolated event and is an unfortunate harbinger of a hotter, drier future that we are headed towards no matter what we do. Indeed, there is a new study published last Monday, 8 days ago, in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, and I'm quoting from the New York Times. They state that since 1979, climate change is responsible for more than half of the dryness of western forests and the increased length of the fire season. Since 1984, those factors have enlarged the cumulative forest fire area by 16,000 square miles, about the size of Massachusetts and Connecticut combined, they found. So, this fire was not caused by climate change. This fire may not even have been exacerbated by climate change, but what we know is that dryness of western forests has been exacerbated by climate change, and we know that hotter, drier conditions are going to lead to more and more of these fires going forward. Indeed, very, very creepy thing that comes from this study. They actually say that this pattern is likely to continue until mid-century when it will stop because there will no longer be enough trees left to sustain wildfires. Ultimately, this is why I, other 350 Bay Area members, and other members of all of the community organizations who've been coming here for years come here. We do not come here to argue with oil industry employees. We do not come here because we enjoy haranguing regulators or spending our days in board meetings. We come here because there are very real-world costs of climate change. And when we hear in your rulemaking proceedings folks complaining from industry about the costs of those rulemakings, the benefits, you know, the avoided costs of, say, one of these fires, which may cost the region $5 billion, is not factored into the cost-benefit analysis. I understand that would be very difficult to do. But it's really worth noting that this $5 billion is going to be paid by us collectively as a society, while the profits get allocated to the few, in this particular instance, the shareholders of fossil fuel corporations. Thank you.
Thank you for coming. I think that is the last person who wants to speak on this topic. Incredible enthusiasm, Jack, and incredible feedback, I think, as well. And you've earned our kudos. And as I mentioned earlier, I think we're all proud to serve on this board and have seen the results that have come over the last almost 10 days now. So with that, I'm going to ask Jack if he wants to make a couple of comments.
Relative to this item, Madam Chair, I think we've covered a lot of ground. I just want to say I want to thank all of you personally for being so receptive and helping out in this crisis. Your staffs, by the way, have been great. And those that don't necessarily have staff, you personally have all been great to work with and listened and made took steps in order for us to get masks to you and your staff and just all of the media and a lot of great suggestions today. So we're going to take it all back. We're still somewhat in the middle of this crisis, if you will.
Yeah,
so we're going to need to take it all back. You'll see the results of, I think, all of this hard work, as a number of good suggestions have come out of today's conversation. And I'll look to a future meeting, Madam Chair, be it either in probably December by now, when I could start to enumerate for you some of the steps we're going to be taking in terms of communication, response, and further steps for the districts to support this unfortunate. Unfortunately, it's as been said, it's going to occur again in the future. So we could learn a lot, and are going to learn a lot from this event. So thank you.
Yeah, well, thank you. And during the time that this has been going on, I've been talking with Marcella and through you as well, Jack, and there is a suggestion that we leave these last two items until November 1st, if that's going to be a possibility. Do you want to say something about that?
Well, I was going to make that suggestion. So the meeting on November 15th, as you can tell, is going to be possibly a big one. And so I want to be able to, at your direction and suggestions in past meetings here this last year, I'm going to have the number of items on the November 15th meeting to be as minimal as possible and just really have us focus on 11-18. That being said, I was going to make the suggestion of maybe moving items number 10 and 11, which is a summer spare the air summary, if you will, but then also looking forward to the winter spare the air season, which actually begins on November 1st. We had pulled and tentatively canceled November 1st on your calendar, so I apologize. I would make the recommendation, Madam Chair, that you think about now convening that meeting and have it dedicated to at least those two items. And probably we can get some other business done as well.
I think so. And as I've told Jack, I think it's important that we try to keep our meetings within this band of time because you all have other commitments, and I really hesitate to keep you longer. And we've done many long meetings this year, given what happened with Spare the Air and everything else there. So I think we will declare that we're going to have a November 1st meeting, and having declared that, how many of you can come? Good. Okay. I think we'll be fine. And we are now missing 4, 5, 6, 7. We're missing about 8 of us. So am I right? Am I math good? So we will plan to see you then. And that isn't quite the end of the meeting, however, because at this point, Jack, do you have more that you would like to say at this juncture? We have down here, our next thing is, I'm sorry, yes, I missed public comment on non-agenda items. Do we have any public comment?
We have 5 names.
Great. Okay, so let's proceed with that. Then any other board member comments you might have had? And last, we will go to our other business, which is at the close of this today. Okay. Greetings, our 5 last speakers.
Okay, I have Jan Warren, Gary Hughes, Jed Holtzman, Esther Grolsby, Angela Scott, and Todd Snyder.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Great idea.
Hello. I'm Angela Scott with Communities for a Better Environment. I'm a resident of East Oakland, and so in my community, the air quality is very toxic. And to be honest, the conversation today about air quality was kind of triggering because our air quality is poor every day. So I live 2 blocks away from the second largest polluter in Alameda County, and also within a diesel truck route, and also right off the 880 freeway. And there is a crematorium that's coming into my community, burning 3,600 bodies a year. All of this compounded with social stressors of being low-income communities of color. It's a lot. It's a lot. And these communities are impacted. I saw people walking around with masks, you know, because of air quality, because of the wildfires, it's been very poor. But the reality is we probably should be walking around with these in our communities every day because, you know, particulate matter in East Oakland and even to West Oakland in these frontline communities is very, it's very poor. And so Community for a Better Environment, I really just want to extend an invitation for the board and for staff. We give toxic tours of our community in East Oakland. And, you know, I got involved with the Communities for a Better Environment, even though I've lived in East Oakland for 20 years, on this toxic tour. And I didn't know that it was, I lived in it, but I didn't know it was this serious until I saw with my own eyes and heard, like, this is what people are living with every day, even if they don't know it. This stuff, after the smoke clears from these wildfires, we're still living in with toxic air every day, and we have been. And so I really want, we really, these communities, we need for BACMED staff not to issue the permit to the crematorium on 98th and Kitty Lane. We need recent testing. There was studies done in 2011 about the impact to communities. We need some new studies done and to address the cumulative impacts of our communities because we are overburdened.
Thank you for coming and sharing that with us.
Thank you.
Next speaker.
Hello, I'm Esther Goolsby. I want to say thank you for all the presentations and the work that put into this. And as Angela has stated, you know, really you get a taste of what we get every day in this neighborhood with these wildfires. I mean, including loss of lives and loss of homes. We wake up and we're breathing in something that's miles and miles away, but we're being told that the emissions from this crematorium is not gonna affect the community that's right there. I think that's a lie. The test that was done in 2011 was outdated in 98 by the US EPA. We need this community to have some justice. We've been sending letters to some of you board members, and thank you if you've been reading the personal testimonies that's on the back of the letters. It's really important because we tell this story to the community and we allow them and we teach them and we notify them. We communicate with them that they have the power to inform you all of what they're living with every single day. We know that these emissions, we know this wire fires is going to have long-term effects. And thank you for that. It's people that don't have homes. They can't stay indoors. They don't have indoors. Children are missing schools. We have foundries that's right there that's downwind from two elementaries, and it's been there for over 100 years. Those are generations that's been living there with this long-term lifetime health hazards. We're not doing data with them. They're just like, oh, yeah, because they live in that area. It's important. And we talk about equity in everything. We need to start right there. With this complaint-based system, the reason why the people aren't complaining, number one, is they're not educated that there is a system. Two, believing that nothing's going to change because the decision is already made. Because lobbyists has already hit people's pockets, because information is destroyed. Where is the compassion and the love for all the people? You say the fire didn't discriminate, right? Between the rich, the poor. We're being discriminated every day because we live in these areas or because we don't make money or because we're not that educated. We need justice.
Thank you for speaking. Our next speaker.
Hi, my name's Jan Warren. I'm speaking for myself today, and kudos to my sisters from Oakland for sharing very heartfelt experiences. I extend condolences to Super Wagenknecht and Zane. I watched the press conferences. We all were glued to our TVs. They did a great job. The whole team did. We should all be inspired by the citizens, the professionals, and the government reps. Why does it take disaster for all of us to come together? My daughter also lives in Santa Rosa and works at the Kaiser there. I appreciate the information that was shared today. As an aside, I found out about the mask on the next-door neighbor. Communications have been good. The last board meeting, I listened to the board meeting online, and the board members here ask very thoughtful questions. They give good suggestions. And sometimes the questions are answered, and sometimes they need to be looked into. And I just wonder how, for those of us who are interested in some of those publicly made comments or suggestions, how we hear the answers. Last night I was at a presentation by scientist Andrew Gunther. Scientists are volunteering their own time to engage the public about climate change and the effects of greenhouse gas emissions. We know the waters are warming and acidifying, and here the fire seasons are getting longer and more intense. We've released 1,400 gigatons of GHGs since 1880, and we can only emit an additional 900 gigatons by 2100 to keep us at the 2 degrees increase. Trouble is, we will blow right past that because we've been increasing steadily. We'll blow past it in the next 30 years. So we've got to do something about that before we can't live on this planet. We should care about toxic emissions, but we should also care about acting more boldly on GHGs. The oil industry gets subsidies and trade allowances. We shouldn't treat them with kid gloves. The governor of California represents the executive branch. The legislators pass laws. It is the responsibility of the courts to determine legality. Good news, a museum in coal country put a solar roof on their museum building to save money. So the economics of business also helps. The Stone Age didn't end because they ran out of stones. So let us quickly transition to the new clean economy. Thank you all so much for your service.
Thank you for speaking. Next speaker. And can you raise your hand if you're going to speak, just so we know how many more there are? Two more? Thanks.
Hello, my name is Gary Hughes, and I work with Friends of the Earth as the senior California advocacy campaigner. Appreciate the attention of Chair and all the directors today. I wanted to bring one issue to the director's attention. We really hope it's addressed because it's something our organization is very concerned. It's not contained at all within the 1118, and this is the air pollution risks from marine spills. We know that one of the more severe incidents that we've suffered in the Bay Area was the Yumuna Spirit spill in September 2016. And even if Phillips 66 wasn't looking to increase more than double the number of oil tankers coming into San Francisco Bay to deliver crude to their rodeo refinery, this risk would remain present. And at this point in time, looking into the horizon, we don't see it coming up at all on the agendas of the Bakhmud here. So we really think that needs to be addressed. And with that, we'd really like to see the directors ensure, again, I've said this before, that this permit revision request of Phillips 66 is considered in its full by the directors, and that it is not relegated to simply a ministerial decision. And we need to get away from the rubber stamp. As it will. And the reason why we need to get away from the rubber stamp here at Bakhmud is that climate change truly is a great danger to our futures, to our children's futures, to our grandchildren's futures. And the recent events in Napa and Sonoma County and Mendocino County are, you know, indicative of that. California also is host to fire-evolved forests, and I think there are a couple of inadequacies in the presentation of staff concerning the fire, the updates that they provided that I think really need to be taken into consideration by the directors. First and foremost, yes, California's forests are fire evolved. Fire is a part of our forests here. Fire was used since time immemorial by indigenous people here in California to actually manage the forest. So we will need to learn how to live with fire. But with that, we also need to be very serious about fire ignition and something else that was not mentioned at all that clearly is very big news in California right now is looking at the attribution for the fires that just exploded in Sonoma and Napa County. And we did speak a little bit about the cleanup that had to be done after the disaster in San Bruno. That there's a certain parallel here. So I hope that the directors here understand the opportunity that you have to take action that helps our society respond to climate change. And first and foremost about that is to secure a just transition off of fossil fuels as quickly as possible. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Next speaker.
Thank you again, Chair Nissen, Directors. Jed Holtzman, Senior Policy Analyst for 350 Bay Area. on October 6th, we sent all of the board members this letter. Thank you to those of you who have read it. I want to highlight that we sent it to you. Really encourage you to take a look at it. It discusses essentially the Air District's permitting program, its history, its purpose, AB 398, the bill that recently passed in the legislature, the effect that that has on GHG regulation at the Air District, and what I would like to use a couple minutes to go over with you, the Air District's remaining authority over GHGs following the passage of that law. So just to remind you, in 2013, the board passed a climate resolution, which led to the development of the Regional Climate Protection Strategy in the Clean Air Plan, basically all of the amazing stuff which we've been here over and over pushing and promoting the staff's work for the last couple years. Basically made very clear that the board understands how drastic the problem is and basically what is needed from the Air District and from CARB to address it. And while AB 398 definitively removed the Air District's ability to reduce carbon dioxide from cap and trade sources, there's still a lot of authority and responsibility that you have at the Air District that you have as board members. And I want to just briefly kind of conceptually go over that. We view GHG regulation at the Air District as a stool with four legs, and essentially leg number one is reducing CO2 at cap and trade sources. That leg of the stool has been ripped off by the state legislature, and we hope that some of our Bay Area representatives will remediate that in a future session. The second leg of the stool would be preventing increases of CO2 from those same sources. That is, preventing, not reducing them, not solving the problem, but preventing the problem from getting worse. You've heard with relation to 1216, some disagreement between the community and the staff about your authority to prevent increases, since that is not reducing. The argument from your staff is we know what they meant, and our argument is laws have letters in them, and we use the letter, and the court decides that issue. Climate change is a serious, serious issue, and if we're not at least pushing the letter of the law, then I think that you're letting your constituents down. So that would be the second leg of the stool there's some argument about. The other two legs of the stool there is no argument about at all, but your staff is planning on putting forward a permit rule for your approval without addressing either of those two planks. The third plank would be reducing all other GHGs from cap and trade sources, so everything not CO2, which they acknowledge they have the power to do but are going to look into doing at some point in the future. And lastly, reducing all GHGs from small and medium sources that are not subject to cap and trade, which cumulatively add up to a lot of emissions. We need to act on all cylinders, and we need to do it now. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Our last speaker.
Thank you. My name is Todd Snyder, and I'm a lifelong resident of San Francisco. I'm here today. I just want to give a shout out to the women who spoke passionately about their pollution in West Oakland. Unfortunately, it seems like that part of our community has turned into a sacrifice zone for the merchants of death. So I'm here today because I noticed that Amendment 1216 is not on the agenda. And I wanted to speak to that directly. So AB 398 that was signed into law by Governor Brown does not absolve you of your responsibility to save our planet. And if you don't choose to act on that, then you need to ask yourself what you're doing here. The world is on fire. And if you abdicate your responsibility to the people that you supposedly serve as public employees, the people who pay your salaries, then you're consigning us to the dustbin of history and yourselves too. As you specifically said, the fire doesn't discriminate. Climate change doesn't discriminate. But AB 398 is not your get-out-of-jail-free card. At this point, the reason you exist is because the corporations don't take into account the cost of their externalities. So I would suggest to you that you get serious about what you're doing here. Are you merely puppets of the corporations that fund your campaigns? Or are you actually going to do something to save our lives? Otherwise, just go home. It's a charade. So please do your jobs that we pay you for with our tax dollars. And get serious about it. Thank you.
Thank you to our speakers. That was our last speaker, and I am going to come back to our public comment, which is was on non-agenda matters, and move on to any other board member comments. This is that time.
Yeah, Madam, you can start with me. You know, the last speaker, I mean, it just absolutely just flabbergasts me. When I hear people say, get off of fossil fuels, if we didn't have fossil fuels, you'd have three counties that would be completely destroyed. There wouldn't even be.
Sir, there's no interchange with the audience.
There wouldn't even be half the destruction. I mean, as I said, three counties. You know, I look at Travis Air Force Base for the devastation in Puerto Rico. I mean, they delivered two meals a day, 30 days for over 3 million people, and they did it within hours of the opening of that runway. You don't do that with electric airplanes. They'd probably still be charging somewhere in Colorado. I mean, the fossil fuels play an important role. Now, can we reduce that? Absolutely. And should we be doing it? Absolutely. But to be making statements like we're irresponsible, I mean, it's just crazy. All of us sitting around this table deal with our constituents every day. We deal with real issues, social issues, and you know, and so we have to. And it's that disrespect is what you deal with. It's that very disrespect.
Sir, I must ask you to stop speaking. You have had your opportunity. This is our opportunity.
So I'm just.
Sir, please desist, please.
So, Madam Chair, I'm just saying that there's a balance to what all of us up here do. And I think to portray it, and, you know, I sit here silently. They make those statements, the public here, and we don't respond. And they think that's everybody thinks that way, and we don't. And we have a responsibility to a lot of people. And I think this board does a really good job finding that balance. And I just wanted to comment, and I think our staff does an excellent job. You know, nobody's going to agree to it. And when speakers get up, they're representing a very specific special interest group, the way they accuse us. But I think we have a much broader constituency and, you know, responsibilities that we all meet on a daily basis, where I think most of the speakers do not. And so I just wanted to respond, Madam Chair, that there's a hell of a lot being done for a hell of a lot of people that are saving a lot of lives that all the members of this board are responsible for. And so, you know, it's irresponsible to say that we're not doing our job.
Also feel compelled to say that this board does not get paid. This is not a salaried board. No one goes home rich serving on this. This is a humane effort. Rebecca?
Thank you very much.
I just wanted, unfortunately they're not here, I wanted to appreciate the women who spoke about their lived experience in East Oakland and reinforce why I think it's important that we do an action which will be coming back, which we've already approved to start on, which is a program to clean up the worst of the remaining old trucks, because a lot of folks live near a truck route, both the 880 and then the on-street truck routes, where there is really a disproportionate impact on the communities there. So I hope we will continue to work on taking that action. And also I'll just request for staff to follow up on the crematorium question separately from this meeting, but just that that continues to be of grave concern, and that I hope we will look at doing more of the mobile air quality sensor program like was piloted in West Oakland. There are whole communities along truck routes, including East Oakland and elsewhere throughout our whole region, that have these concerns, and it would be great to send those mobile vehicle monitors out and get a sense of how, you know, what are the readings. And now that we've all had the horrible reminder of how bad the impact of PM is, I hope that when the issue of the refinery caps can come back to us, that we will look at the issue of a PM cap. I know we keep having these arguments about the GHG cap, but the PM cap was clearly in no way state preempted, and so I hope that we will look at that particularly. We've all been reminded of the roughness of the PM. And thank you all.
Thank you, Director Kaplan. Director Miley.
Yes, I just wanted to chime in on a couple things. One, the speakers and Director Kaplan mentioned this, that came from East Oakland to speak about the crematorium. Is that going to come to Stationary Source for an update?
Director Miley, I don't believe so, actually. I need to check with the staff. I was just checking with Jamie Williams, my director, and I just need to get an update on where we are on that permitting activity. So the reason also is I don't think we have a Stationary Source Committee scheduled, actually, anytime.
But I just think it would be good if we could bring it to Stationary Source just for an update. You know, I know the answer because
mm-hmm.
we've been down this road before.
Right.
But I right. just think it would be good if we could bring that to the committee so that the public could have an opportunity to hear the staff okay. and the committee could weigh in and the public could speak to it. That's okay. kind of what I'm looking at. Now, okay. you know, I think that'd be better than you and I or your staff coming with me to meet with them. And Rebecca Kaplan, she represents all of Oakland, but I represent East Oakland. And we could meet with them, but I just think if we did it through Stationary Source, that might be an easier route.
Right, right. You'll have a room here, and you can accommodate a lot of folks.
Yeah.
So let me take a look at that. And
yeah.
The schedule in my head is it would have to be after the 15th of November,
yeah.
so probably the week afterwards.
Yeah.
But I'll look.
I think that's fine. And like I said, I know the answer because like, we've been there before, and I know we do what we need to do and what we have to do within the letter of the law and what's scientifically permissible and allowable. Now, I'll also co-sign Director Spearing's comments, maybe not as passionately, but definitely I think we have to sit and take abuse as elected officials, and rarely do we get to put that abuse back on people who are maybe misinformed, but I do want to co-sign your comments.
I am looking around to see if there are any other comments. And coming back to, pardon me?
No, executive officer's up.
That's exactly where we are. So we're now on item 14, which is a report from our executive officer.
I'll reserve my air quality summary till next time because we'll have a spare the air discussion, both winter and summer. But I do have one announcement, which I will give to Jean Ruggenkamp. Actually, I'll let her give that announcement.
Thank you, Jack. I know the hour is late, but I did want to take just a few moments of your time. I've been serving this agency for 33 years and have loved virtually every minute of it. It's been my honor.
Wait a minute. Can we bring this one back
yes,
November 1st?
Right.
This isn't what we were hoping for, Jane.
It truly has been an honor to serve this agency, this board, this executive management team, all the staff and the public of the region. Air quality has improved dramatically in my time here, except for last week. So I couldn't be prouder, and I couldn't be prouder and more happy to have had the opportunity to work with the folks here at this agency and the board members who have served on this board. It's really been an honor. I feel very fulfilled. I'm kind of sad about retiring, but I am going to retire at the end of the year, and I need to let you know that. So thank you very much. And I will be around for a few more months and continue serving diligently because I have a passion for this work. But it's time for me to retire pretty soon.
Wait a minute. 2018, Gene. Just one more year. I move we postpone this action. I'll just express appreciation. Maybe there's another time. But all that you've done to educate me when I've had questions, you've been very responsive and very helpful. And, this is a scientific and economic undertaking that we do. And we try to balance interests. And you've been inspirational to me. So thank you, Gene.
And this has been an unusual year. Not all of you know that, but we, particularly Dave and I, have frequently met with staff, especially during the cap and trade era, and Gene has been invaluable. So, this has been a long and a hard year, I think. Topped off by forest fires, it's hard to believe. It's like, what else? Must be pestilence coming. Okay, very sorry to hear that, Gene. That was not what we anticipated. So I do not, I know you're going to be glad to hear that I have a chairperson's report, but I do want to tell you that nominations for the 2018 board officer are now accepted. So here is, most of you know how the rotation goes, but you begin as secretary, as Katie is this year, you move up to vice chair, as Dave is this year, and if you're good enough, you move on to president. So what we're looking for is somebody to sit in the secretary seat, which means that you need really 3 more years. And I don't think it would penalize you otherwise, but I have been involved in a number of situations where people have made commitments and didn't get reelected or decided not to run. So I would urge you to indicate that you've got those 3 years that you can devote to the Air Board before you say, yeah, I'm willing to do that. Many of us have term limits. Lots of you don't. Blessings on you that don't. But for those of us who do, we really have to be very cognizant of that. So if you're interested in serving, please let Mara Sella know. She's right over there. Let her know. You can email her. And we're going to do the nomination committee at 9 o'clock on November 15th. I'm correct, Mari. And then we will announce the results that day or not until December? That day? Okay, great. Okay, if there are no other comments, do you have any questions about the nominations at all? Okay, in that case, as you know, we've moved our next regular Board of Directors meeting to Wednesday, November 1st, at usual time, usual place. And at one of these meetings, we're going to have a goodbye cake for you, Gene, or a pie, depending on what you like. So if there are no other comments, I had something from David. Would you like to say that? Oh, go ahead. It's your turn.
What I just said to the chair is that I thought we should, in light of what was happening, adjourn memory of the fire victims. And so that's what I propose. So I don't know, Madam Chair, if you want to move forward with the
I think it's appropriate. Yes, I will take that as a motion to adjourn and to honor the victims who were in the fire. So is there any dissension on that? If not, thank you all for being here, and we'll see you again, hopefully, in 2 weeks. Thank you. Mask delivery, Jack. Do you want to say anything finally about that?
We'll be in touch with everyone, Madam Chair.
Okay, so anyone who needs masks would get in touch with the
With who? You, Jack?
With me.
Okay, get in touch with Jack.
It's got metal on it, so I don't think it's open.